Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1069 with Souther Teague.
And Maury Margo, five nights a week, it's one person. So five nights a week, you're the only guy in the room. If you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. But if you're the only guy in the room, by default, you're the smartest guy in the room. So you're still in the wrong room. So we have to strive to continue to learn, to take in more knowledge. So that's what that means, right? If you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room, because there's no one for you to learn from.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then, join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO-optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero-commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at owner.com/unstoppable and see why owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
This episode is brought to you by Mies. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary IP and stay in sync, giving the culinary team the ability to both create recipes and distribute them from the same platform. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser-accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yield of ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Meez account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, the creative drunk, Souther Teague. My man, Souther, are you feeling unstoppable today?
It is unstoppable. It's an unstoppable day. Look, it's raining, but that's not going to stop us.
Yeah, man, I'm psyched to be here. You're one of these people who are kind of breaking the mold of what it means to be a food and beverage professional and breaking the old, like, 1905 business model and just trying to, like, be a part of the new normal and just, like, leverage your knowledge, your skills to make a life in this new normal that we're just thrusting ourselves into. But you're more than just a creative drunk. You're also the beverage director. It's for the entire restaurant group. What's the name of that group? One more time.
Overthrow Hospitality. Drink, start a revolution with Overthrow Hospitality.
You're the co-host of the Speakeasy podcast.
Yep.
You're the founder of Souther Hospitality.
Yep.
And you also authored a book, I'm Just Here for the Drinks. So, like, man, you are a jack of all trades. I think that this is what you have to do moving into the future to really kind of to make it in this industry. What are your thoughts on that statement?
I don't know that it's what everyone has to do, this kind of thing.
It's definitely an option.
I think that, you know, as a bartender, which is what I kind of really still think of myself as, you're a creative, and creative people like myself need creative outlets. Mm. You know, So yeah, I've done all those things because I needed to kind of get them out of myself. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've done so many, many, many things that sort of relate to food and beverage because that's kind of where my, you know, knowledge base is.
Yeah.
But aren't necessarily connected to my spaces, you know. I just do them because I need to get something done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, being a creative, being artistic, I mean, art is a form of experience. And we're moving into the experience economy. We're in the experience economy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you've been in bar and restaurant, you've been in that economy your whole life,
yeah.
Right? That, which is all I've ever done. My dad owned a bar when I was a kid. I've been in this field. It's the only field I've ever been in.
Yeah. So I know there's going to be some great stuff in today's conversation. I cannot wait to dive into it. But let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling with the success quarter mantra. What do you got for us?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my dad said a lot of things to me when I was young. And one of the things he said the most was, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. Mm. And I know that's, you know, an old saw, but it holds true, right? And this includes, in fact, and I think that maybe I added some of this on in my career, because at Amore Margo, my oldest bar, which just turned 13 two days ago, by the way.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Lucky 13.
Yeah.
Not bad for a six-month pop-up. you know, at Amore Margo, 5 nights a week, it's one person. So 5 nights a week, you're the only guy in the room. If you're this smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. But if you're the only guy in the room, by default, you're the smartest guy in the room. So you're still in the wrong room.
Mm.
So we have to strive to continue to learn, to take in more knowledge. So that's what that means, right? If you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room, because there's no one for you to learn from.
So I feel like the natural progression is to move on, right?
So
what is the balance between paying your, you know, like not developing a name for yourself in the industry as somebody who just sticks around for a couple months and takes off?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is that balance? Like, what do you think is like the number you should give an employer before going on for the next experience?
I mean, I think my bare minimum is a year. And I'll back that up by saying I kind of cut a deal with all my employees that involves that number, right? I say, look, if you come to work for me, I'm going to imbue you with all the knowledge that I can over the time that you work here. I'm going to make sure you have a safe, comfortable, functioning place to work. And I'm going to do everything I can in my power to make sure there are, you know, as we say in the business, asses in seats, which means you'll make money.
Right.
And if I do all that for you, then by proxy, I'll make money, right? Or theoretically.
Right. I'm making a note, asses and seats, because I think that's, I want to come back to that.
Sure.
I think there's a lesson there.
So if I'm doing all that for you as my employee, what I'm asking for in return is that you show up, be prompt, follow my tutelage, and give me a year of your time.
Mm.
You give me a year of your time, and I will give you all of those things I just said and one extra piece, which is, and I'm always trying to be humble about this, I don't know who or what it is exactly I am in this field, but I'm something. And if you give me a year of your time and we agree to this contract, this sort of unwritten contract, you've got me forever.
Yeah.
You live in fucking Des Moines, Iowa, and I know someone there who's looking for somebody, I will help you get a job.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest patterns. Did I cut you short?
No.
That's one of the biggest patterns I've seen, is it's really just about helping other people get to where they are. And when you make your life about lifting up other people, you can't track it, but it comes back around. And
it
that's,
sure does.
And that's really what we're trying to do with this podcast, is to make example of people with you, but really just your values and your perspectives, to show people, you know, if it's your job as a restaurant or bar owner to give your team the picture of what the job done right looks like, where does the restaurant owner go to see what the picture of the job done right looks like?
Yeah, I think, you know, my good buddy Dave Wondrich said, you know, if you want to write about cocktails, you got to do a lot of drinking.
Mm.
If you want to be in the restaurant business, you got to go to a bunch of restaurants. You can't be interesting if you aren't interested. So get out there and visit all the places that you read about, all the places that look interesting to you for whatever reason, right? Some things may look interesting to you because you're like, I want to emulate that. And some things may look interesting to you because you think to yourself, I want to make sure I don't emulate this. Mm. But you got to go there.
Yeah.
Right? You can't see it in your own, you know, again, it goes back to that thing. If you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room, meaning I can't learn anything from myself. I have to go look.
Right. And I think the other really important thing before we move on to your story is just getting multiple different perspectives, not staying one place too long, because whatever works for one person isn't universal.
No.
You really have to take all those bits and pieces from a bunch of different perspectives and angles to put together a little bit of from this person's experience and this experience and this experience to chart your own path, I think was one of the other big lessons I've learned.
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, every bar and restaurant is its own thing in its own entity, unless it's a chain, you know, like Applebee's or whatever. But even those, they generate their own personality through their staff, right? To some degree, there's still stuff to learn from there. You know, one of my dear friends, Travis Tober, was one of the original, you know, trainers at TGI Fridays, you know, and he still carries a lot of that sensibility with him through his business. Yeah. You know,
I had Travis Nickel on the City. Show. Yeah. Nickel City. Great story. If you want an episode about how to throw an event, check out that one.
Oh, yeah. Travis is.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Awesome.
He is a party.
So bring us to the beginning, man. Like, give us an idea of how you got to where you are. And like when did you, like, when does it make sense to start sharing your story?
I mean, I don't know. I grew up on the North Gulf Coast of Florida. I hated it there. I left 4 days after graduating high school when I was just 17 years old. I've lived in 12 states, right? So this shows that I have like a hunger to move around.
I can relate.
And kind of gather, right? My dad owned a bar when I was a kid. You know, I remember hustling like cases of beer from the walk-in up to the bar, and he'd give me a quarter so that I could go play one of the pinball machines that we had. So he was getting his money right back. You know, it's a great system for him. And I got into kitchens early on because, you know, wherever you go, people eat. So jobs were plentiful. And then I ended up going to culinary school and realizing that that was not necessarily for me when I got out of it. But I did have a good career in kitchens. You know, I worked for a lot of great places. You know, most notably, I think for me personally, I was an instructor at the New England Culinary Institute for 2 years, the same 2 years it was rated the number one culinary school in the country by the International Association of Chef Professionals. No coincidence.
A little flex.
No coincidence there.
Flex away.
But I think most notably to other people, I was the research and technical chef for a show called Good Eats on the Food Network with Alton Brown. Kind of a big deal. But I never really felt a connection until I got an opportunity to be behind a bar. And then I said it was a chance job. I was going to do it for 6 months only to help a friend of mine out. And I stood behind that bar for 3 years. Took me at least a year to kind of figure out why I wasn't going back to the kitchen.
Yeah, dive into that. You mentioned that it wasn't for you, and then you went on to go say all these accolades and achievements you've made. And it's really surprising that you were able to stick with it and be that good at it.
You know,
while not having a passion for it.
I think. Listen, my dad was a great example in a lot of ways. He was also a terrible example in a lot of ways. We don't have to get into those. But you know, his job. He worked for NASA till he retired, but down in Cape Canaveral. But I have no idea what he did, right? He didn't bring it home. He went there because he was good at the job and he did the job. He came home to his house on the beach with a Harley Davidson in the garage and a pool in the backyard, and he lived a great life, right? I don't think he liked his job at all. And I think that's set into me, right? I can be very good at something whether I like it or not.
Right.
And I was very good at cooking,
yeah.
Right? I just didn't love it.
Wasn't there for you?
I don't think it was... It seemed very, I don't know, just kind of mechanical, which is fine too, right? I was known as a technician, right? Give me the dish, and I'm going to make it the way it's supposed to be made.
Got it.
And I went very far with that, you know. And I was a butcher for a couple of years as well, which is very technical work. And there's stuff to be enjoyed, like the sort of calmness of repetition, you know, the repeated actions and
flow state.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You get into that zone where you're just like doing the thing. But I never really had like a real passion for it. And I think really the difference was the guest interaction.
Mm.
You know, we'd have those nightmares in the kitchen where you're like, thousands of dishes went out to the dining room tonight, you know, and you see a couple of them coming back and barely any food left on, and they scrape into the dish and, you know, that's it. But then you have this nightmare that like, there was no one even out there. The servers go out there and they scrape some food off, and then they come back with a plate and scrape into the dish. You know, like, who are we doing this for?
Right.
And when I got behind the bar, it took a while to realize that instant connection with the guest, that part of the, I'm part of the evening now, or the afternoon, whatever. I'm part of the experience. And that's what we're talking about. There's a lot of experiential stuff. So I think I got as much out of the experience as the guest did once I was in the front of the house.
Did you know what you were missing? Like, how did it make you feel?
I had no idea.
You had no idea. Right. So you didn't know until you knew.
Right. You don't know until you know.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, so just looking at the timelines here. So you graduate from the California Culinary Academy in 94.
Yeah.
I see that you start the brand Creative Drunk in 2008. And then 3 years before you, I mean, I'm assuming it was no sooner than 2005 that you got back into, or no later than 2005 that you started
2004.
Doing, 2004. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think this is also around the time where like just after this is when you start seeing more open concepts where like you can see the fruits of your labor going out in the expression.
Sure. So, and I worked at a restaurant that was like that. We had a chef's counter, even, you know, nine people could sit at the counter with us, and there was a little bit of interaction there, and I think maybe that was a job that I touched on back to when I was at the culinary school, where suddenly now I'm teaching, you know, maximum class size there was 9 people. So up to 9 people that I'm having to interact with, you know, face-to-face, talk to. And now, you know, I can't yell at them. They're not my employees.
Yeah.
Because we're live kitchens at every class at New England Culinary. They're not my employees. I'm theirs.
Yeah.
So I had to, like, not yell at somebody for doing something wrong. I had to say, well, here's why you did it wrong. Let me show you how to do it right.
Right.
You know? So then I started talking to people more. And then that's the last job I had before I got the job that I said I was helping a friend behind a bar, right?
Okay.
And so suddenly I was talking to people, right? And they were my boss. You know, who cares? When you're a bartender, it doesn't matter who hired you. Your boss is the guy who's leaving the money on the bar, right? Or girl, right? That's who you're really working for.
Can you describe how it felt when you now have this new whole new perspective on the industry where you get to experience the end result?
Well, it's not just getting to experience the end result, although that is certainly part of it. It's getting to experience the level of desire and commitment that the guest wants from you and learning how to suss that out. And I think I'm a pretty good student of the human condition from, you know, honestly, from moving around so much as a young person. So, you know, you have to understand that some people want you to make them their drink, their Negroni, whatever, and sit it down and walk the fuck away. Can you swear on this thing? I've already done it twice.
Yeah.
Okay, dude, good.
But anything you could say is nothing worse than I've ever said. Cool.
They want you to walk the fuck away. They're not here for you. And generally speaking, that's true of most of your guests at a bar. They're not there for you. They're there for whoever they're with. They're there for the atmosphere. They're there to sink into a book or whatever. But so you have to learn to be able to say, I know when to drop the drink and walk away, or I know when to set it down and they want to know what gin I used, what is vermouth, tell me all about Amaro, you know, like, let's get into it. So you have to find that line.
It's very dynamic. It's every table's different.
Every guest is different.
Right? So you like searching for that. You like the dance of like, what level of me do you want?
Yeah, I do.
And what is like, so is there a rendition of guests that you prefer to work with, or like, are you searching for that person that wants you more of you?
You know, I think it's totally dependent on honestly me and the night, you know, or the day. Sometimes I want to be really engaging. Sometimes I'm just like, just drink the drink. I'm alone. You know?
No, I mean,
cause I'm a person too.
Yeah.
You know, right?
100%.
Sometimes like people come in and they have so many questions and I'm just like, oh gosh, again, but you know, one of the things that I teach my staff and I talk about for myself as well is, the ability to remain unjaded, right? It's a difficult task to do. And let's use Amore Margo as a pristine example of this. You know, we have the world's largest collection of tincture bitters, world's largest collection of potable bitters. We don't use any juice. We don't shake drinks, like, you know, all stirred, all bitter, all serious.
First
drinks.
Bitter bar in New York City.
I think it's still the only one in the world, right?
Right. Well, maybe there was like a 70-year gap. I'm sure there might have been one before you, like, sure. In the early 90s.
You know, I still don't think another one exists because, you know, lots of people have come forward with really heavy Amaro lists. Lots of people have come forward with, like, really Amaro-driven bars. Yeah. But they still use juice. They'll still shake a drink. You still get a daiquiri. You know, maybe it has some chinar in it, but it's a daiquiri.
Yeah.
Here, it's stirred bitter only. But the example I'm going to use is we've been open 13 years, and literally still every single day, at least one person comes in and says, so, you know, just tell me, what are bitters? Now, how many times do you think I've answered that question?
Thousands.
How many times do you think that guy's asked that question?
Once.
Right. I have to remain unjaded and tell him with some excitement and exuberance the answer to the question that he is curious about because of a business that I built that drives that curiosity.
Right.
I can't be angry at the monster I built.
Well, I think that's where like showmanship comes in, where like there is a level of acting that happens.
And I have a pat answer that I can rattle out so fast.
Yeah. But it's weird because you think of acting as being very fake and very transactional,
right?
And very like, I don't want to act. I want to be authentic. I want to be genuine. But do you generally give a fuck about that person's experience? Then put the fucking show on.
Yeah, man.
Because that matters, right?
Right, because they're here, and they're here because you created a place. We can take Amore Margo out of this now, whatever restaurant or bar you've created. You've created a place that drew someone's curiosity enough to darken your door with the intent of spending their money, and now you have to put on that show, if you will. I tend to not think of like the bar as a stage and a show and all that stuff. It's still just human interaction. I just want to be cordial and nice and deliver what the guest is sort of expecting.
Right. Well, you look at the root of hospitality.
And I want to over-deliver a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of don't want to over-deliver a ton.
Why is that?
Because then you raise your own bar, right? And then you become this hype beast that can eventually never live up to
it. You become the ultimate warrior.
Yeah.
Do you know the story behind the ultimate warrior?
I don't.
You know who the ultimate warrior is, right? Wrestling? The guy with the face paint, he would shake the ropes and he had the long hair and he was just jacked beyond
My last memories of wrestling are like 220 pounds of twisted steel and thick appeal, dusty roads.
That was around like a little bit after. We're talking like 90s, you know. So like, but he, the whole thing is like he had this unsustainable persona, and he basically just burnt out because he had to bring it all the time,
right?
And it was just unsustainable. So to your point, like you have to maintain that level. You can't have. You have to bring it every night, whatever level you come up and show up.
Well, listen, especially in a business that is highly reliant on regular guests, if I blow you out of the water, what am I going to do your next visit?
Right.
That's a good point. And your next visit.
Finding
and
that
then
balance.
Suddenly you're my guy who comes in every Sunday, and every Sunday I got to blow you out of the water again.
How do you find that balance?
You can't. You have to justify in your own mind that, you know, one of my former bartenders, Sean Johnson, good friend of mine, lives nearby here in Brooklyn. I'm not a sports person at all, by the way. So this is why this lands better, I think. He said to me, and I'm probably going to butcher this, and somebody's going to write in and say, he did it wrong. Yeah, I'm telling you, I'm going to do it wrong. Relax. He said to me, like, you know, you can bat 333 for your career in baseball and be in the Hall of Fame. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that means. He goes, 333 means
one out of every three.
One out of every three
one out of every three.
One out of every three times you approach the plate with a bat in your hand, you connect with the ball.
Yeah.
One out of three. And you're in the fucking Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
We are expected in our business to hit a home run every time.
Right.
It's unsustainable.
Right.
So as soon as you can just let that go, you know, the better answer, the better analogy for me is the knife fight. You ever been in a knife fight?
No, fortunate.
You have to just relax your mind and know that you're going to get cut.
I used to wrestle, and I think that's a good analogy. Like every once in a while, you're going to get slammed.
Yeah, you're going to get cut. So, you know, well, a knife fight, every time you're going to get cut.
I don't want to find
out. So it's
just
part of the fight. It's part of the fight, right? Yeah. So you know, I say the same thing. I say the knife fight thing to my team whenever the health inspector arrives. Like, we're going to get cut. We're not going to be 100%. They're not here to let us go with 100%. Something's going to get hit. So relax, you know. So I have to say to myself, I want to overdeliver just a little every time if I can, but I know that I can't every time.
Right.
If I do it one third of the time, then I'm doing great. I'm in the Hall of Fame.
Are you familiar with the book Unreasonable Hospitality?
Oh, of course. Will Goddard, amazing.
Yeah. So in that book, I think you'd probably argue the opposite, where you have to blow it out of the water every experience.
I don't know. I think I've read the book. It's downstairs on my bookshelf. I've actually I know Will. We've hung out.
Fantastic book.
Yeah. We've hung out in the past long ago. One of his high school friends and I are friends. We hung out at 11 Madison Park one afternoon a long time ago, and he was great back then. I could see the greatness in him then. But he does that series on Instagram where he reads stories.
Right.
I sent in one and he read it. So like,
oh cool.
It's pretty cool. I don't think he thinks you got to knock it out of the park every time. I think you got to consistently maybe want to knock it out of the park every time. Every time that batter approaches the plate, he wants to hit a home run.
Right.
But he's only going to connect with the ball one out of three times.
But sometimes you just have to do the unexpected. The thing, it might be just a little thing that says, I'm paying attention to the details.
For sure.
But I think my only critique of that book is I think that he has a very, I don't know. Like they aren't cheap to go to that restaurant.
Oh, no.
If I'm wrong. So like they have a lot of resources to do things that are unexpected, like having somebody on staff who is a calligraphist, the person that writes fancy.
Sure, sure. Calligraphy artist.
Yeah. So like,
I mean, he's not there anymore, right? 11 Madison Park.
Right.
But 11 Madison Park has a department in their system called the Dream Weavers.
Yes.
These people, you get these advance reservations that are 2 months, 3 months, 6 months out
right.
for an anniversary, and they're going to make sure something.
I think it's a great book. Yeah, great lessons there. But I think my only constructive criticism is like you can't hold yourself to that standard because they are serving the top 1% of the top 1% of people, and they have resources to do those types of things. So don't think that you're a loser if you don't have like this dream team. You can be inspired by that for sure. What are your thoughts as I'm speaking?
I mean, I think that he illustrates that pretty well with his Instagram content right now, which is to say there's plenty of things you can still do. And that's why people write in these stories. They're just from some little bar in some little town somewhere that they did something nice for someone and it was a big deal. Mm. You know, you don't have to spend a lot of money to do these things. You just have to, I think you said it earlier, you just have to be paying attention to the details and highlight those details.
Yeah. Juxtaposition. Just do things that aren't expected.
Just make someone feel like you heard them and you saw them. Literally, that's it, man.
Yeah.
if I heard you and I saw you, you will feel good about me. Yeah. Right?
I'm loving the conversation that I'm totally just getting derailed from your timeline, but I'm about it, man. It's cool. There's great stuff coming out. So
a long timeline.
So, I just want to make sure, because I mean, 1994 to 2004, you're back of house, you're a culinary instructor, mm-hmm. You're learning that world. I mean, are there any just like aha moments, transformative, like points for you, perspective shifting experiences that you can share with us in terms of like how to elevate that part of the game?
I'm sorry, when I was in the back of the house?
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's 10 years of your come up, like other key mentors.
That's also after I went to culinary school. I was in kitchens before that too.
Right.
You know, I was in kitchens enough to say to myself, I think I should go to culinary school, which I wish I didn't. You know, listen, what I say to people all the time, and I went to culinary school and I kind of wish I didn't. And then later in life, I taught at a culinary school. So I had to change my tune about this. You know, you have to wear the suit that you're wearing for the job you have or whatever. But now that I'm back out of it, you know, for a long time anyway, I say don't pay for culinary school. It's absolutely not a waste of money, but you can do this better. You can grab yourself a notebook or your digital notebook now. I used to say grab a Moleskine or whatever and a pen. Go out and get two jobs, working the daytime and the nighttime at the same time. Work at kind of a low-tier, divey kind of place, you know, just a joint. Work at somewhere as nice as you can get in. Tell both of the kitchen heads there that this is your plan, to work for them for 6 months. Ask as many questions as you can. Take as many notes as you can. Quit both jobs. Do that again. Do this four times. That's your two-year degree in culinary that you got paid to do.
Right. Side note.
This information is out there.
You can go anywhere in the world and do that.
Yeah.
You can't do that after you have $100,000 of debt.
Yeah, you come in and you say, I'm eager and I want to learn from you. Yeah. That's going to pump their ego. Yeah. That's going to make them better. You know, again, if they're in their room, that room that we talked about earlier, if you're the smartest guy in the room, if they're in their room and they've just been digging their trail and doing fine, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But if they aren't, you know, teaching is learning.
Yeah.
So if you're suddenly tasking them by saying, well, why do I do it this way?
Yeah.
Then they've got to formulate an answer,
right,
which will make them more articulate.
Right.
They'll be a better value to their next employee.
Right.
You'll be a better value to your next employer. This is a great way to
100%.
It's the apprenticeship model.
Really. 100%. And I think that needs to come back, you know, 100%.
Agreed.
Like there's so, like we need help and there's people who want knowledge. Like, why aren't we leaning more into that? Why aren't there, there are networks out there.
Yeah.
You see the top of the top doing it, the Daniel Bluds of the world. They share, they pass people around, like they know, mm-hmm. For sure. And I would just say, like, take that approach that Southern just shared with us. And if you want to learn Southeast Asian food, go to Southeast Asia and do that.
That's like, where they're eating it every day.
Exactly. Like, you can always go back home if you're 17, 18, 19, 20 years old. You know, like, you can always go back home. Like, go get that experience.
Yeah.
And it will be so good on paper.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I think, you know, even what you just said, go get that experience. When I left home, it was all in America. You know, I didn't actually even leave the country till I was 42, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But I lived in 12 states here in America after I was 17, until, you know, I got here, basically. I've been here for 20 years now, 21 years. Going around, seeing people, and when I say people, I mean just other people, even if it's just in another state, you're going to get different experiences.
Right.
You're going to learn things about yourself. You're going to learn things about the human condition. You're going to learn things about what people like and don't like. This is going to help you. And if you're going to stay in this field, this is going to help you, right? You're going to be a more well-rounded citizen of Earth if you can communicate with whoever walks into your door, all the better.
Yeah. I'm loving the conversation. We're going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors. We'll be right back to start talking about the transition from back of house to front of house. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. Ugh. With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps, and reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website.
We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust owner.com to power their restaurants online. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. We're back, and now let's, unless there's anything else that you want to get out in terms of the come up, that 10-year run post college, before transitioning to back of, or sorry, front of house.
I mean, the only thing I would say is, like, let's not forget that 10-year run. I was already in it for 10 years before that. I'm 54 years old, right? I think it sounds a little, you're making me sound young when you say that, which I don't mind. Young is good. Young is great. If you're young out there, try and stick with it.
Is there, like, should we transition to the more front of house stuff, or is there, like, I just don't want to miss any, like, transformative key parts in your career that really kind of
there's a lesson to pay for. I think if I would say that there are some lessons to learn from the back of the house, they mostly came from my time as a butcher, which then I carried into kitchens with me as well. When I was in the butcher shop, I was responsible, of course, to break down all manner of meats, but I also learned, you know, skills like charcuterie, sausage making, curing, smoking, etc. And what all of those taught me is patience, right? You know, we can't make a ham. Can't make a ham overnight, right? I feel like we are inundated right now, and I'm not bashing. I'm a part of it, right? I'm on Instagram. I got a pretty heavy following. You know, I'm not on TikTok yet. I try. I keep trying.
You might maybe not have that option.
maybe they'll ban it. I don't have to think about it anymore.
My fingers are crossed, man. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. But I mean, so many people rely on it for their livelihood. I don't want to see that happen. I think we're inundated with so many things. You know, a ham? You know, a ham's going to take me literally weeks to make. But I can show you how to make one in 30-second clip on Instagram. So we've gotten this weird lack of patience, I think, as a whole, as a society. I don't mean just people in our business. Just as a whole, everyone wants everything. It's instant gratification. You know, like, you know, just add water. Boom, it's done.
Right.
So I think I learned a lot of patience in the back of the house, especially from butchery. And then I took that skill from butchery to the places that I worked, and I put things on the menus that were beautiful and exciting and you know, pâtés and sausages and ballotines and galatines and things like that. Things are kind of old world now, but and those are the things that people pay for when they go to, you know, quote unquote fancy restaurants.
Right. And you're stretching every last ounce of that product that you're purchasing.
For sure. Yes.
Yeah. So you really increase,
which is that. Also huge. Yeah. Now that you're talking about that, Garmanger was a big deal for me.
Yeah.
That's the station in the classic kitchen that, literally the kitchens that I worked in, people would have to pass their what they were about to throw away.
Right.
Would have to pass my station.
You're making money on fat.
Would have to pass my station to go
yeah.
the garbage.
Yeah.
They'd be like, I got all these bits of a bell pepper.
Yeah.
And I would either be like, get rid of them, or I can use that.
Right.
So, you know, patience and, you know, commodity of usage.
Got it.
Right.
So you,
which
you,
are huge things right now, right?
Right. For well, sure.
Patience isn't. But, like,
you know, we live in a weird world. You know, it's a weird world, actually.
We live in a weird timeline. The world is fine.
Yeah, I mean, I reference the Joe Rogan show often. I know not everybody is a fan of Joe Rogan, but I love his interview style, and I love the subjects he brings to the, because he's just a curious guy, and he goes to people
I mean, I get a lot of inspiration from his show and what I try to do, just going to people who are
just
smarter.
Just don't get radicalized.
Right, right. But he,
I liked him fine when he was on that show where he made people eat bugs.
I mean, he does get some really interesting people who share, but they talk a lot about this stuff, you know, and like, it's weird because I feel like my mission statement is to learn from people in the restaurant industry, but I'm also trying to transform the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things, like, I think the restaurant industry has the power to transform the world. But to your point, like, we're living in this world where we're so short-sighted. Like, we're just going through the motions of doing all the stuff we have to do because it's what we're told we have to do. If we don't do it, then we're at a disadvantage. And it's almost like all fear-based. If I don't do this stuff, if I don't post every day, if I don't, it's right. Just like, at what fucking cost?
Yeah.
Like, what are we doing? We're so short-sighted and just going through the motions of what we have to do. No one's happy doing it. I don't like doing it. Some people enjoy it. I mean, I get that. But
masochists?
Right. So I don't know. I think it's good that we talk about this stuff because I think that there's an unreasonable expectation. Like, we talked about how unreasonable the guest expectation is on the restaurant. Like, we have to hit up, you know, we have to bat a 100. Like, that's not sustainable.
I think it's 1,000.
1,000. Yeah. See, I'm, thank you.
I'm not even the sports
I mean,
guy.
We could definitely but go down
the phrase
hole.
Batting 1,000. I guess that means so hitting it every time.
Before I get too far down that rabbit hole, let's just back off. I'm going to backpedal away from that. And let's go back to your timeline. So, you start focusing 2004, 2005 on the front of house. By 2008, you are the creative drunk. You are consulting.
Oh, that's when I, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, according to your LinkedIn timeline, it started in 2008. So this is when you start. So 4 years of front of house experience, you're now consulting?
Yeah. Well, don't forget, my dad owned a bar when I was a kid.
Right.
I had been in restaurants that had bars all my life. In the back of the house. So I started doing some consulting of both, actually, in New York. I was consulting on some kitchen menus as well as some bar menus in those early days while I was working at places like, trying to think where I would have been in 2008. I was working at Dovetail. So my bar timeline goes from working for a semi-large group here in New York, Be Our Guest. That's the job that I worked on the Upper East Side. And you know, it was just the Atlantic Grill. And it was just a big, I think they seated 220-something people. And it was kind of like, it's on the Upper East Side. It's kind of like a diner for the Upper East Side. And the Upper East Side in New York City, by the way, is a pretty wealthy neighborhood. It was a seafood restaurant, but like we had regulars who came in literally 3, 4, 5 times a week because it was just in their neighborhood and they could spend $80 on lunch every day, right? Wealthy people. Or, you know, spend more than that on dinner every night. It was kind of like the strangely, a local joint
okay.
For wealthy locals.
Got it.
I don't know, kind of forgot where I was going with that.
Well,
my next jump was, I was like, okay, this is fine and I'm making good money, but I don't have enough, respect isn't the right word. They were doing fine stuff, right? I always make the joke, you know, the kitchen there, because it was a group and because it was supposed to be like reliable all the time, right as rain every time, you know, they were like, what do you think if we add peanut butter to jelly? I don't know. We serve milk on the side? Bingo. We got a winner, right? So like they weren't breaking any new ground, which was fine. You know, we served like a tuna dish that had a wasabi mashed potato. Yeah. You know, they weren't really cracking the mold, right? So then I started working for chefs behind bars, right? Oh, so okay. I'd worked for chefs in the kitchens. So then I got a job with John Fraser at Dovetail, which was, you know, beautiful, amazing Michelin star place. I worked for Grey Coons at Cafe Grey, also a Michelin star place. So I got to work in behind bars that had kitchens that were strong, that I could go into the kitchen and say, back to my old roots, right? Yeah. I'd say, what do you got that you're putting on the menu? Do you have any scraps of that item left over that I can turn into a syrup or an infusion or a shrub or something for the bar? And then we got drinks that go with the food.
Right. So now you're taking a chef's approach to bartending.
And I'm certainly not the first to crack that egg, you know, and make omelets out of it. But I think I was early adopter of that because that was my career. I came from the back of the house.
From scratch, everything, you know, down to the bitters.
Yeah. So I was making... By the end of that sort of part of my trail, I was making everything I could possibly make.
Elixirs, tonics.
I was making fucking, cordials. I was making my own triple sec. You know, I was making ginger beer. You know, I remember clearly one day looking at a bottle of Roses Grenadine and searching the bottle for the word pomegranate. It's not on there. I was like, why don't I make my own pomegranate syrup, you know? Yeah. So like dumb little things like that. you know, just flipped it over. So I got to employ both my skills, my new skill of bartending, and attach that to my old skill of
skill. How do you find the balance between the cost of labor to do that and profitability?
It's funny because it's coming back around to bite me in the ass. So now let's jump ahead a little bit from there, I guess.
Where were we? Is that between 2004, 2008? Were you talking about this time frame? Okay.
So then if we leap a little bit forward from there, we'd get to Amori Margo's creation, which happened in 2011, March 21st. But obviously some planning and thought going into it before that. Yeah. About 3 weeks. No.
3 years. No. So you started like 2010 and by 2011?
Yeah. At least the thought process anyway.
Got it. What was the vision?
The vision was to create a space that focused on tincture bitters mostly to highlight them. And the space that we wound up with was just so small that we made the decision to not have anything else. People come in all the time and they're like, why don't you have daiquiris? And I'm like, where would I put a juicer?
Right.
But the space was 240 square feet.
I mean, I feel like if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I'm doing one thing really well and I'm putting all my energy.
Listen, I have a story about this that I tell so many times. I'm sure people have heard it on other podcasts of mine and others. Listen, I've spoken in front of people all over the world. Largest group I ever spoke in front of was in Kiev, actually. Barometer, get it? Over 750 people in the room seated, and then there were people standing. So let's call it, I don't know, 800 plus people.
Wow.
Like I felt like a, you know, mid-level comedian. Like I've never seen a
selling out casinos.
Right. I've never seen a crowd that large in front of myself. But I run up on stage and I look out to the crowd and I say, hey guys, I'm so excited to be here in Kiev. I saw there's a new restaurant down the street that serves spaghetti and sushi and tacos. Who wants to go with me after this? And like the whole crowd kind of grumbles. That sounds terrible. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I'm just so excited. They only serve spaghetti. Anybody interested? And then people are kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I'm like, how come you don't think about your bar like this?
Right.
You'd never go to a restaurant that tried to serve everything, except maybe a diner.
Or Cheesecake Factory.
Right? But both of those places are going to always kind of be a little bit mediocre or slightly disappointing on all points.
Right.
So my bars, since the beginning, the first bar I opened was Amori Margo, my bars are all hyper-focused.
Right.
I'm serving spaghetti or sushi or tacos, not all three.
Right. And I think it's worth bringing to the narrative, too, that you're in New York City.
Yeah.
Where there's something for everybody. And if you're trying to be everything to everybody in a city like that, there's no possible way.
Yeah, I get this response sometimes. And I agree. In New York, I could literally serve broken glass and rusty nails.
Want to stand
There'd
out.
Be enough people to be like, I don't think I'm going to try that. Yeah. And I could sustain my business probably for a while. Until all of them died from eating broken glass and rusty nails. Not the drink, the actual nail. But I still believe this is true anywhere you go.
I agree.
If you want to, you know, it's going to be disappointing. It's consensus. If you make a consensus, if you and I, and let's add a third person in the mix, are standing on the corner of where Amori Margo is, 6th Street and Avenue A in the East Village of New York City. Everything is at our fingertips. And the three of us say, let's catch a movie. Do we walk to the nearest movie theater and watch whatever's playing right now? No. You say, like, I want to see that new action movie. I say, there's a foreign film that's got subtitles I want to check out. You know, our friend's like, there's a new chick flick. Let's go watch that. Romance.
Korean
you
know? Drama.
We decide what we're going to go see together because we're going to go together. And I'm not pissed that we're watching, you know, a romance. You're not pissed that we aren't watching action. I'm not pissed that we aren't watching a subtitled French movie. I bought my ticket. I'm in on the romance. Let's go.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that the guy up in the booth can do. He's got the reel. He's putting on the movie. He can't make a different movie for me.
Right.
So that's it. We bought the ticket. Same three of us stand on the same corner. We say, let's get something to eat. Do we go to the nearest place that serves food? No, you want spaghetti. I want sushi. He wants tacos.
Right.
But here's where it starts to get sticky. We end up going to the taco place, but I wanted sushi. They have some fish on the menu. I ask, can you make it? They've got rice on the menu. They might try because it's hospitality and they want to please me.
Right.
Guess who it's going to be bad for?
You.
And them.
Right.
So both of us.
Right.
You got to buy your ticket. The last thing would be same three of us. Comedy comes in threes. Same three of us, same corner. Let's get a drink. Generally speaking, we go to the nearest place with drinks. You wanted wine. I wanted a beer and a shot. He wanted some of this weird Amaro from this place that only does Amaro. Probably all three of us, wherever we wound up, are a little bit disappointed because right. We didn't take that moment to say what we wanted, decide on the thing, and buy the ticket.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm 100%. This is probably one of my bigger aha moments in the 1,060 plus episodes is you cannot be everything to everybody. Especially
you're over 1,000 episodes.
Oh, yeah, man. Almost 10, over 10 years now.
Holy guacamole.
It's fun. I love it. But clearly, I keep showing up. So, I mean, I think when you are in a city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles, it gives you a little bit more liberty to get more creative with what that one thing is, because mm-hmm. there's somebody out there looking for what you have. So I think 100%, like if you have a vision, if you want to do one thing, I think do that one thing. Don't reverse engineer the market and give the market what, like, because I think you won't be as happy. Go to where your thing will work. You know, you might have to move if you're stubborn on that one thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's no right answer. I think in terms of like, for every piece of good advice, I've found a countering piece of good advice.
I mean, I always say, to my team, you know, like it's raining today. Tomorrow they may say, "Oh my God, we were so slow last night, probably because of the rain." They may also say, "Oh my God, we were so busy last night, probably because of the rain." There's right. no guessing.
Exactly.
We don't know.
So, right? So you start. What was the biggest, I mean, going back to this idea, were you a partner from day one?
No. I was brought on as an employee.
Okay.
The partners that were the actual partners moved on, and then that's when I became a partner.
So when did that happen? What year? Like how long were you just an employee?
1 year in. Yeah.
1 year in.
So 2012.
So you came in as the beverage director?
No. It was just four of us on the team. There was no need to have titles.
Okay.
Right.
But you rose to the opportunity that opportunity of beverage director.
Yeah. So these guys were partners with my current partner, Robbie DeRossi. He had, you know, control of the location.
Right.
And that's why he never bartended right. in his life. But
yeah. And this is where when I give my guests the warning of we talk about weird things, partnerships and stuff like that. I think it's so important to talk about what have you learned about
polygamy. You can be married. I think people
that's
think
the I always use that analogy. Yeah.
I think people think you can only have one partner. No, you can have a zillion.
Yeah. As long as you're communicating and you're not holding secrets and you're fair, you know, and mm-hmm. like the expectation's clear.
Yeah.
So like along that line, what have you learned about partnerships? Like what have you learned the hard way and what have you learned from other people's stories?
Yeah. Well, from other people's stories, I learned like what you just said, communication is key. You know, even at the top of this show, you read off some legalese, like get a lawyer involved, get your own lawyer. You can't, if you're a partner with someone, you can't have the same lawyer because then if anything goes wrong, who does he fight for?
Conflict of interest.
Right. So you have to have your own lawyer. It's just a cost of doing business. Like if you're not factoring that in, you're going to wind up screwing yourself.
Yeah. If you're going to get $1 million to open a restaurant, it's like operational expense.
$5,000 yeah. to get a good contract written.
You can afford it.
And the best thing about it is if things go right, you never need it.
Right.
You know, you just put it in a drawer and there it is.
Exactly.
And then you never go to that drawer. But if you have to, there it is.
Yeah. And it's a line item when you're getting started. It has to be there.
Yeah. Just as important as, I don't know, three compartment sink.
Yeah.
It's a must have.
The more I think we get into the future, I think the days of being a single unit operator or like multi-unit operator, one owner with a bunch of people working for you, are kind of in the past.
I think so too.
Why? Yeah. What's your perspective on that?
I think that if you're a savvy business person, you draw people up from your own company to become partners. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to slice the pie any thinner. It means that you have to make a bigger pie. Mm. So that would be to say, if I was going to bring up someone from my team, we would open a place for them. And we've done that, you know, with plenty of our chef. I mean, you know, technically we only have the one. My company has several locations. We only have the one actual bar. That's Amore Margo. Everything else is a restaurant. But we've, a good example is we took one of our cooks from one of our restaurants. She was often making family meal for the team. And it was she's Mexican-American, and it was Mexican food. And we were just like, should we just open a Mexican place and make you in charge? And we did that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, you know, it's just smart business to identify the people's in your company's strengths and then to set them to that strength.
Yeah. My most recent book is 10X is Easier Than 2X. Have you heard of it?
I haven't,
but it talks about
makes
this.
Sense.
Yeah, 100%.
I already understand what it means.
Yeah, and it's this idea that like if you double, if you 2X something, you're just doing more, mm-hmm. right? And like you're doing twice as much work to get twice as much outcome. But if you 10X, you are recognizing what's the 20% of the things I can be doing mm-hmm. that I'm uniquely qualified to do,
sure.
And how can I surround myself with everybody else that's doing their 5 or 10% or 20% of what they're doing. And then you just go further together and you create layers between you and the work and you 10X it.
Yeah.
Like that is actually physically easier than trying to double your output.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I think we're all already, you know, redlining on the output that we can do. We're all, if you're in this business, you're kind of an alpha, right? You're a motivated person. You want to stand out. You want to be creative. You want to say the funny thing, you know, in the group. You're the guy who talks in the elevator.
Right.
Right. Nobody talks in the elevator with alphas. Right. So, you know, we have all that, but you have to realize that you're only one you. You can't be in multiple places at one time. You can't, you know, and that's really strict when it comes to bartending. If you want to talk about a real eye opener for me from kitchen to bar, is that when you go to, I don't know, pick a chef's name, Wolfgang Puck, when you go to one of Wolfgang Puck's, you know, 30 something restaurants all around the world, you're eating dinner and you think to yourself, Wolfgang's in the back. He fucking cooked this. Bullshit.
Right.
He hasn't been to this location in months.
Right.
Right.
If ever.
But because you never see him.
I'm sure he's been to all those restaurants.
Because you never see him and you wouldn't see him anyway, then you just assume he cooked this for me.
Right. It might not even be his. I mean, it would be his intellectual property because he hired the person who cooked it. But it might not even be from his mind.
Right. Exactly. But you go to a bar and it's either me or it isn't.
Right.
Right. I can only be at one bar at a time.
Right.
So you can't scale up in my side of the business. You can't just double your output. The only way to do it is to bring other people in and to exalt them and raise them up, you know?
I think the other variable too is that it's no longer just running a restaurant. I feel like there's so many more, the expectation on what has to happen for a restaurant business today. When you talk about, like, I think the next big thing is seeing more marketers who are restaurant partners, because that world of marketing is becoming such an important variable.
For
like
sure.
You're good at marketing. Want to buy like 1% of the business, you know, you can have stake in the business and we'll give you a paycheck. And have like your on staff marketer. Like,
right.
That's going to be more.
It's like some of your best partners are like a plumber.
Right. I'm seeing it happening at a pop-up level right now.
Yeah.
No joke. I literally just interviewed these three dudes, New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire, Dead Proof Pizza, Matt, Dante, Vinny, shout out. Matt is the only chef. It's a pop-up. He does the pizza. His first partners were marketers.
Right.
That's brilliant because he knows it's that important, especially with a pop-up, because you have to get the brand out there.
Right.
So, I mean, this is the new normal.
I think so. And, you know, it's funny you would say bring up pop-ups. You know, Amore Margo was only slated to last 6 months.
Great transition. Yeah.
Yeah. we kicked off the thing. It, you know, I said there was only four of us there. We all had other jobs, you know. And after that first 6 months, it was like, well, it did pretty well. Do you want to go another 3 months? Okay, cool. We'll keep going. So I'm going to work 7 days a week because I got my other job and I'm working here my only nights off. We used to close at 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
Because it was like, if I'm working here on my night off, I'm going to close at 11 so I can still have, you know, kind of a night off.
Yeah. is the pop-up game then the same as it is today? Do you think it's changed at all?
I think it's changed a lot based on what you just said. Like, we didn't have a lot of like marketing power. We were just like, we're going to do this weird thing. And it was largely a clubhouse for us. Like, we were all interested in bitters and Amaro, and we just wanted to have a place that was full of those and people could come in and we could talk about them and nerd out, you know?
Yeah.
And then we got some, you know, some press and we became like a little industry darling, you know, industry nerds love to drink bitter things back then and still, you know, love to push their palate envelope. And that just bought us some cred. We extended that 3 months to make it 9. Then we extended 3 months to make it a year. And then we extended 3 months. That's when I became partner, right? He wanted to extend another 3 months. And I was like, look, man, I've worked 7 days a week now for a year. We're going all in and I'm quitting my other job or this is over.
Right. But I think some of the best things ever, or I don't want to call it unintentional, but like it's just two people coming together, or more than two people, a group of people with a similar passion coming together and just doing the thing that they would do if they could, you know, do it for the rest of their life, not get paid for it.
Yeah.
Like if they had all their liabilities taken care of, they could just do one thing for the, like whatever that is, if you can make money doing that. And there's also a certain allure when there's that level of passion associated with it because it resonates different with people.
I think you're also tapping into a little bit of something that is a bit of a myth is the wrong word. It's the dream. And I think it's an impossible dream.
Which
is to say you're working with people who all have the same passion.
Yeah.
Nobody has the same passion as you. Bottom line is, in the end, if you go out there on that limb and you open up a business, whatever that business is, in our field, in other fields, whatever, tires, shoes, whatever you want to do, nobody is going to give as much a shit about your business as you do. And you have to get over that. Mm. You just have to get over it.
I can get behind that.
You have to understand that, like, I always say, like, let's just use, again, just Amore Margo, not the whole company, but maybe the whole company, to be honest, now that I think about it. I'm the best at whatever job there is to do at Amore Margo, all the way down to fucking washing the dishes. I'm the best. I am better than anyone there. If I can hire people who are at least 70% as good as me, we're golden.
Right.
Right? I'm not looking for you to be me because you just don't care as much as I care.
Right.
I'm going to make sure every dish is clean. I'm going to make sure the floor is swept well. I'm going, because it's my place.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get that from you. I'm just not.
I think this whole mindset
if I can get 70%,
right,
I'm doing real, real good.
Well, this isn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the whole foundation of the book, Setting the Table, is built on this principle of, like, setting the table, like, you're constantly going to have to put this all back, shake it right back to where it is, because nobody's going to give a fuck like you give a right fuck. And if you expect them to, you're going to lose your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I think, what happens to a lot. You know, we say in the field, we often talk about how, like, why are so many owners crazy? This is why. They drive themselves crazy. They allow themselves to be driven crazy. You know, you got to plan your work your plan, and be flexible.
Mm.
And that flexibility comes in a lot of fashions. It comes in the fashion that we're talking about now. I got to understand that no one's going to care about it as much as I do. I got to understand if I can get 70% out of them, what I would expect out of myself, I'm doing fucking great.
Lots of breathing exercises.
Yeah. Too. I got to understand that I opened up. So let's even look at, we're just going to constantly look at Amore Margo. So back to Amore Margo. You know, when we opened, our tagline is a bitters tasting room. We thought people were going to come in and, like, taste tincture bitters with us, with seltzer water, and then drink Amaro. And then they came in and they're like, well, what do you mix this with? And we became a bar, right? Like a cocktail bar, craft cocktails. We really expected that people were just going to come in and be like, oh, Amaro Montenegro, never heard of it. Pour me a glass. No, they're like, Amaro Montenegro, make me a drink, right? So that's where we had to be flexible. If we didn't bend to their whims a little bit, we would have been gone in 6 months.
Yeah. I think that's really important, that flexibility too. Whatever your vision, whatever your dream is, whatever you think your concept's going to be, there's that dream and then there's the reality. And it's like,
but you can still be firm.
Yeah. You got to hang on to whatever you can.
We're still quite firm to this day, you know? And don't forget that we've always been, we just moved the day before New Year's Eve, we finally closed the original room and moved next door into a much larger space that we took over because of the pandemic. but we were always a 240 square foot closet in the back of another bar. Right? It had its own entrance, but we were behind another bar, right? There was a full service. It changed over the years many times, but the most recent one, it was Mother of Pearls, a very sort of, you know, tropical slash tiki bar. And when I say behind it, I mean, we just had to walk 30 paces through the kitchen and we're in that bar from the employee side. Like, my guests can't do that, but I can. So to say to someone, to look at someone dead in the eye and have them say to me, like, can I get a daiquiri? Like, I could have walked through that kitchen and gotten lime juice. I would also have to grab a shaker and a strainer, but and I could have made him a daiquiri. But you have to just be like, no, we don't do that here. Again, you've come to the hamburger stand, sushi's at another place.
What happens when you hold your ground, especially in a city like New York, where I feel like people are just really strong-willed individuals? Like, how do you hold that ground of, you know, like, draw that line?
Yeah, unapologetically.
Okay.
You never, you know, I'll give you an example. Max Green, good friend of mine. Really good friend of mine, worked for me at Amore, and he's the nicest guy. He is the just fucking salt of the earth dude. Met him. He was the doorman at Death & Co. just down the street, and I was like, this guy should bartend. He's so fucking nice, right? So I got him behind the bar. He had bartended some before that, but and I remember seeing him one night, and a guy came in and asked him for a martini with olives. And Max was very apologetic about the olive situation. We don't have them. And I pulled him aside and I said, look, man, I'm gonna break your finger the next time you apologize for something we don't do. He goes, what do you mean? I just wanted to let him know I was sorry we didn't have olives. I was like, do we ever have olives? Because we don't.
Right.
Our only garnish at Amore Margo's twists, orange, lemon, grapefruit. That's it for 13 years. And he said, I want to make sure that this guy feels that I'm caring for him. And I said, you can care for him, but you can tell him no for something we don't have. You know, you can say, we don't do olives here. I'll offer you this with a twist. And why is that important? Well, if that guy goes, okay, well, I'll take a twist. You apologize for not having olives. I'll take the twist. But then he comes back in a week and he says, I'll have a martini with olives. And you go, I'm sorry, we don't have olives. And you go, okay, well, I'll take
these guys
twist.
Are never have olives.
What the fuck's the matter with these guys? Yeah. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So no, we know exactly what we're doing. So you just have to be firm.
Yeah.
Firm but fair.
Confident.
Firm but fair, and confidence is key.
Clear in your identity of who you are and what you're doing.
Right. And again, it's so strange to me how difficult it seems for people to jump over that same hurdle with drinks when it would be so easy for them to jump over with food.
Yeah.
Can I get a hamburger? I'm sorry. This is a sushi restaurant. They wouldn't bat an eye. They wouldn't be like, oh, well, can you make me a hamburger? Why don't you get a hamburger in here? You know, they'd be like, oh, right. I'm at a sushi place.
What were your biggest challenges with the Mori Margo early on?
No was the biggest challenge. You know, we would say no three or four times before we got to a yes. Because in the very beginning days, people would come in and say, ooh, cocktail bar. I'll have a daiquiri. No, we don't have juice or shaker. And just because you say that to someone doesn't mean they know what that means. You know, we don't have juice or shaker.
Well, especially 10 years. I think the average consumer is getting a little
bit more
educated.
Yeah. Oh, believe me.
Yeah.
And that's great. Consumer.
Because of places like yours that educated people and the word got out.
Listen, being at a bar is like, getting an education. And if that's true, Mori Margo is a university level.
Oh, I'm sure.
But so they'd say, can I get a daiquiri? No. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a fancy cocktail bar. Can I get a last word? Okay, that's just a fancy daiquiri. So no. So you go through two or three no's before you're finally trying to coerce them into getting what it is you do.
Was it scary at first? Do you think that like people would just be like, screw this place?
Yes and no. And the scary part was alleviated by the fact that we were going into it knowing that it was going to be a 6-month pop-up. So it didn't matter.
So there was no 10-year plan.
Right. Didn't matter. This was supposed to be just a flash in the pan. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. Get the fuck out.
I think that's one of the things I love about a pop-up is that there's just such like, you have an excuse to do exactly one
thing. It's ephemeral, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, I do some events here in my house and my apartment. And, you know, I make it quite clear that this is a one-off, one-time event.
Yeah.
There are no substitutions. If you have any kind of allergies, this isn't for you. If you have any, like, I can't do it for you.
Right.
Well, this is what it is tonight, and that's it. And pop-ups kind of have that, too. Sometimes a pop-up's 2 or 3 days. Sometimes it's a couple months. But, like, they're like, this is it. This is all we got, and we're out of here. But my thinking is that should be how you are kind of all the time. You know, there's an argument that goes on in the bar world all the time about pre-making cocktails, batching them. And then I will watch people online fight it. No, we never do that. We don't make a drink right in front of you so it's fresh. It's like Subway, fresh sandwich. Yeah, is any of that meat cooked today? That's all cured deli meat. You cooked that literally weeks ago. Nothing's fresh.
Yeah.
So they're like, fresh. And then I see that same person at an event, you know, where 500 people are coming, and they've got buckets of their cocktail. And I'm like, why do you pre-batch here but not there? Why do you batch here but not at your job? And like, well, there's a party. I know people are coming. And I go, yeah, every night when I open my doors, I know people are coming.
Right.
It's a party.
It's about throughput.
Yeah, right? So, like, it's just about confidence. You know?
I was actually going to ask you about that, where you lie on this idea of, like cocktails on draft.
Yeah. I was one of the first in New York to do it. We got in trouble.
Why?
Because it was not allowed.
Because of just people getting too drunk?
No. So in the state of New York, it's still on the books, but now no one cares because of my tiny little bar. It's crazy that you're bringing this up. I forget this all the time. When we opened, we had two taps on the bar. And at first, we were making two different vermouths, an amber and a sweet. And we were using those in cocktails. But after that first 6 months, when the pop-up was supposed to end, I was like, look, nothing else here doesn't come out of a bottle. We don't make anything. We don't squeeze juice. We don't make syrups. We don't do infusions. So everything is just in the bottle, meaning that, you know, the eventuality is what that meant was that if you come to a Mori Margo today, you can get something from the first menu and any menu in between. Because if the bottle still exists, we can make it. Because we didn't make a thing to make that drink. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was like, the only two things we're making are these vermouths. Let's quit making those. We'll rely on vermouths. Now we have, you know, anywhere between 18 and 25 vermouths at any given time at a Mori Margo. But I'm like, well, I got these two taps. What am I going to do with them? So we started making tap cocktails. And like it's always in a Negroni style and then like a spritz style, something that we pressurize and get some bubble on and something that we just push out with enough pressure to push it out. And we got written up in, some paper, New York Times, maybe, I don't know what it was, about having tap cocktails. And the SLA, State Liquor Authority, came down on us and said, you can't do that. Because strangely enough, in the state of New York, This is where the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. The letter of the law says you can't literally make cocktails in New York. You can't take anything from the vessel that it came in, put it in another vessel, mixing glass, shaking tin, punch bowl, and then into the glass or whatever that's going to be served in.
Okay.
So the keg counted. It counted as like you made a thing that's not in the bottle.
Well, I see. This is why, finish yours.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the law is on the books to protect makers and consumers.
Yeah.
This is so you can't empty the bottle of Belvedere and put in Ketel One or whatever.
Right.
Right? That's the technical reason this law exists.
Yeah, because it's easier for somebody to do sketchy shit with it and contaminate.
Right.
And, I get it. It makes sense, but I think this is why I'm such
old sense. Right. It doesn't make current sense.
Exactly. And I think this is why I'm such a middle of the road kind of person when it comes to left or right. Like, I feel like I'm very moderate. Like, I see both sides. Like, I believe, yes, we need policy.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's like, policy is dangerous because we live in a dynamic world.
Sure.
And the laws we make today don't make sense. And changing old laws is hard to do.
It's hard to do, and they don't change fast enough.
Yes.
So here's where it wound up. So we had to go to court. And there's an exception to this rule, by the way. And you might know what it is. In the 80s, they were everywhere. And they're still kind of everywhere in New Orleans. The frozen daiquiri machine. Right? The guy who made the first frozen margarita machine. So that's the exception to the rule. You can have that because it's in continuous motion. So, you know, my dad working for NASA, I got some science on my side. I'm like, cool, we'll go to court. We went to court. We said to the judge, here's the keg that it's in. The keg is under pressure, meaning the liquid inside is in what's known as Brownian motion at all times.
Vibrating.
Yeah. And the judge was like, picked up his gavel and was like, all righty, no, click. Right. Let's come back.
No.
Come back and try again. So we had to go back. So what I did was I said, well, you know, back in, you know, seventh grade science class, you have that little magnetic plate that you sat your beaker on top of, and you have that silicone wrapped, metal pill that you drop in the bottom, and you turn on the plate and it spins the pill, so it's stirring. They make large ones. So I got a big old magnetic plate, sat my keg on top, dropped in that big old pill, turned it on, made it spin, told the judge, it's now in motion. And he was like, deal. Now that thing cost $3,000. I had two kegs. Plus, we had the bar.
Still a lot less than hiring a lawyer to change the law.
Plus, we had the bar next door, which had like 7 kegs of cocktails on it. So we showed him this. I took the thing out. I sanitized and cleaned it, put it back in the box, shipped it right back to the guy that I bought it from, got my refund, and no one's ever said another word. But what I'm saying is letter of law versus spirit of law. Now that we've proved it can be done, no one gives a shit.
Right.
Because again, if they really gave a shit, they'd have to say, well, you can't put anything into a shaker and shake it. You can't put anything into a mixing glass and stir it. You can't put anything into a punch bowl and serve it.
What can of worms are you trying to open here?
Right.
Yeah.
So it cost us some money to have to go to court, but we got tap cocktails for the state of New York. You're welcome.
But I just want to highlight.
Smallest bar in the state of New York got all that done.
I just love this idea of like, don't take no for an answer.
Right.
Like turn on that frontal lobe and ask how.
Yeah, let's get into
it. And like, there's always a way. And like, no, like the answer is never no. It's just you haven't thought of a solution yet. And like, you will be so amazed at what your mind can come up with if there is no obstacle that you will let get in your way.
Yeah.
And just think and talk to people, share ideas, make it a group effort. Like,
sure.
It's so powerful what a collective of minds can figure out to get around things.
Yeah. Well, not only to get around things, but to at least shed the light
on
things that are stupid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get why it existed. It shouldn't exist anymore.
Right.
And now it's largely. It's still on the books, obviously, but it's ignored.
I'm not going to open this, but I think another great example, I'm going to use that as an example. We don't have to dive into it, is the issue of tipping. You know, like, does it make sense? Where do you fall? Actually, should we open this can of worms? As a bartender,
you probably I would never bartend if I weren't tipped.
Okay.
If it weren't a tipping economy for that field, I wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be worth it to me.
What about?
I would have stayed in the
kitchen. What about a livable wage with tips?
I would have stayed in the kitchen because I make well more than a livable wage, and if tipping were taken away, it would be a reduction in pay for me. I get that there's a lot of people would be an increase in pay.
What about the future of the industry? Like we're talking about now, like talking about putting cocktails on draft, where the idea behind that is that you got to learn how to do more with less. As the cost of operating goes up and all these different things, the cost of goods go up, ingredients go up. You got to learn how to make up for it with saving in labor and not paying somebody who has like a degree in cocktails or just the amount of time it takes to create a cocktail.
Well, I would say to you that what you just described anyway, and we can talk about other things too, but describing a program that's maybe heavily on kegged cocktails, let's say. Let's call it all. Like Yours Sincerely here in Brooklyn is a cocktail program that's all on tap. They have 20 taps. 10 of them are bubbly. 10 of them are flat. So you're saying your theory that you're positing, at least what I'm gathering, is that by doing that, we'll reduce the labor. No, we won't. The bar is open from 5 until midnight. The bartender must stand behind that bar from 5 till midnight.
Right.
If everything's on tap, he had to get here early to put everything in kegs. We've just increased labor.
You're the expert on
we've
this.
We've radically increased the speed of delivery of the product, but we increased his labor. He had to come in hours early to get all those kegs filled.
But I guess the question is your amount of throughput in a five-hour shift going to offset the amount of work to do the putting the drink into the keg? That's the question, right? Like, can we make more overall? And I don't know, like, you're the expert. Like,
right.
I wouldn't even try to go toe-to-toe with you on that subject.
I mean, I'm just saying, let's assume that that keg has a spirit that you just open up and pour in the keg, but a syrup that you had to make that cost you some time in the kitchen and some energy and some effort. Some juice that you had to squeeze that cost you some time and energy and effort in the kitchen. Like, there's a lot more that goes into it to make it.
There's a ton of variables too. Yeah. Like, how big is the space? Are you serving 500 people?
Right.
Like, then put everything on kegs because there's no way that you can keep up with that amount of people looking for cocktails. Right.
You might be shaving a bartender off the schedule.
Yeah.
But you've shaved him off to make him come in the daytime and make those kegs for the guy who is behind the bar.
Got it.
So you've still got two guys.
Got it.
And now one of them's unhappy because he's not in the tip pool. Mm-hmm. And how do you make him happy? Now you have to pay him more. So now you're paying the guy more, right? It's not a win. Like, people think that. And I think also, I thought where you were going to go with this was like the beer tender analogy, which is like, it's unfortunate but true that a lot of people who work at, you know, fancy beer bars, we have one called Proletariat, they get just a dollar a drink, even though the beer is $7, $8, $9 a pint, whatever it costs based on the weird, our bars, rare, new, and unusual beers. We have a lot of really interesting stuff that comes through, and it's pricey. Beer's pricey. But they're just getting a dollar, you know. Why is that? Well, you think, well, they just did this, right? No, man, my guys have worked here for 10 years. They are experts in this field.
Right.
They lugged those kegs downstairs. They cared for them while they were in the house. They attached them to the taps. They know everything about that beer. They know the hops and the, you know, they know way more than me.
Right.
So you're not paying for what happened right now. Same thing with that kegged cocktail. Why should I give this guy any money for this $15 cocktail that he just did this? Well, he came in hours early to make sure that this keg was perfectly made and delicious so that this night would go smoothly and your drink would come quickly. You should tip him more.
I mean, there's so many variables. And like, no two operations are exactly the same.
No, of course.
And so it's a very complex, you know, convoluted subject. I don't pretend to have the answer.
I don't either. Sadly, like... Man, I would like to get to a place where we have universal, you know, universal wage for everyone, you know, just for existing.
I mean, if AI keeps on progressing the way it is, that might be the only option.
Listen,
who knows? We live in such a weird time right now, man.
We picked a weird timeline. Yeah,
it's so exciting though. At the same time, to be alive right now, where aliens might be real, like and like all this crazy stuff.
I'll
going
talk
on.
About that forever. There are no aliens. It doesn't exist.
Well, there's. What about parallel universes? What about infinity, the concept of infinity?
I don't know that I necessarily subscribe to parallel universes, but I can tell you why I think there aren't aliens in pretty brief. We don't have to get too far off topic because we're here to talk about restaurants, but maybe they have them in space. I doubt it. It's that time is bigger than space. Space is huge. You say there's billions of planets. Surely there's another planet out there that's got, you know, intelligent life on it. I agree. But when? Before we were here? After we're gone? The fact that the two of us would arrive at the same time is impossible. Mathematically impossible.
Well, I mean, you're talking about one dimension of space.
Well, right. You get into parallel universes and other dimensions. Now we're on a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's just a crazy time to be alive.
Right? Yeah, everything all at once, right?
So I don't know. I don't have any of the answers, but I love to just like to think about this stuff because it really just puts things into perspective of anything's possible. There are no rules.
Yep.
To your point, like you can think of things. Like there's infinite possibilities. I mean, this is kind of related in the sense of like, what is quantum physics? Like, and I don't know if this is an analogy I like to use, but like you and I in this experience right now are living two parallel realities at the same time. You know, you have one dimension, which is like, it's flat. You have two dimensions or it's a pop-up. You have three dimensions. You're playing Mario back when it was the first 3D, like run around the world. Like you have all perspectives of Mario. And then you got today where like, if I'm looking at this camera that's pointed at me and you're looking at that same camera, we have two different realities of that camera.
Sure.
You're looking at the side of a camera, I'm looking at the front of the camera. And like, it's infinite. And I think that like every human being has a different perspective based off of their life accumulation of experiences, of their values, their beliefs. We live in a like multiverse. Like it is literally like that is infinite realities.
Sure.
You know?
Because they're a multi of us. It is a multiverse.
Exactly. And it's their unique realities to one perspective.
Yeah.
And it, and like when you think like that, it's like, oh, no shit. Like now, yeah, but I think it's important to think like that because there's literally no rules. And like, and it also helps to like with this idea of like the biggest thing behind like social or emotional intelligence, empathy, mm-hmm. of like, it's all connected. It's all tied in. Like, that's why I love talking about this stuff because it's like, what does that have to do with the restaurant industry, Eric? Everything.
Yeah.
You know,
everything's connected.
Yeah. Anyway, back to your story. I'm loving the conversation, though. So you start to make this transition, it seems like, in 2017, where you're no longer focusing on necessarily, like, you are the bar manager. You have those responsibilities. You bring that to the restaurant group. But you also start thinking about, like, what's Souther? Like, what do you want to do? Like, Souther, like, the brand, it's standalone brand, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so what's going through your mind around this time where you're like a part of a team to like, you like, what made you break off and do your own thing?
Well, this is where, this would be the part of my timeline where I like was really explosive, right? Up until that point, I had focused all of my energy on Amore Margo. And even though tiny, tiny place with at any given time, 4 employees, it took a lot. Right. So like bear that in mind if you're thinking of opening a bar or restaurant. It takes a lot. It takes a lot out of you, but it'll give you a lot back if you mm-hmm. allow it to. So I focused really heavily on the bar and making sure that there were asses in seats so that myself and my team would generate revenue and be profitable, make money, have a living. You know what I mean? Like suddenly when you have employees, you suddenly switch into parent mode. You know, I've never been a parent, but I've had a lot of pets. You switch into parent mode and you realize I'm not just taking care of myself. I'm taking care of these people too.
Right.
I fuck up. It impacts them. You know, I don't pay the fucking plumber to come and the sink's back up and we're closed for a night. Someone lost a night's pay.
For sure. I mean, that's why I think fiscal responsibility should be one of everybody's core values because sure. of this sole purpose.
Yeah.
You need to provide security to other people.
You need to provide security to other people. You're beholden to maybe some investors if you have them, you know, luckily we didn't. You know, like there's plenty of people that you're suddenly responsible for, not just yourself. So that changes things. So I spent a lot of time focusing on that. And then finally I got to the place where I was like, I think I'm ready for a second child in this analogy, right? So I partnered with Max Green, who I spoke of earlier, and we opened a little bar called Blue Quarter. At that same time, I partnered with some friends of mine who had a restaurant, still have a restaurant on the Lower East Side, and we opened a bar called Windmill. And when I say at that same time, we did this over the course of 2 years. In a 2-year span, I opened 4 new bars.
Wow.
After having one for whatever, 7 years, 6 years, something like that. And I wrote a book and did a book tour.
But what was happening in that first 6 years?
Like I said, I was focusing on the bar. I right. was trying to build our visibility and presence by being, you know, to be honest, what I did the most is I stood there. And that doesn't sound like you're doing something. It sounds like a little bit passive, but because I was there day in, day out, I was behind that bar the most.
Behind every great restaurant, behind every great bar is a great person.
Yeah.
Maintaining the standard, elevating people.
Sure. Being the face of the place.
Yeah.
You know, I was behind that bar for so long, so many nights a week that I became part of the bar.
That's dangerous.
It is. And it was very emotional for me to finally rip away from that, which I only did kind of when the pandemic came. And that was even heartbreaking in the way that that happened because I didn't get to have like a last big celebrative night.
Right.
It was just like, I just don't really bartend much here anymore. And, you know, so what I was doing was a little bit passive, but at the same time, it was, let's step back 2 steps. I get asked a lot from young bartenders, like, what's a piece of advice that I would give them? That would help their career. That's maybe not like, you know, shake with both arms so you don't wear one out. You know?
Good advice though.
It is. And I say, stand still, stay in a place, be known for being at a place. You know, we talked earlier, like a year is kind of my minimum, you know, yeah. Like if you can stay at a place for 3 years, that's better. And here's why. Because people would say to me, like, how come you're always in the press? And Maury Margo's always in the press. And you're always getting quotes, pull quotes for stuff I don't even do. You know, I get a pull quote about juicy drinks from Punch or something. And it's because I'm becoming a known expert at that point in my career. And I'm reliably where I say I'm going to be. So when I would get a reach from, you know, a quarterly magazine that's only going to come out every quarter and they'd want a quote from me, they could say Souther Teague of Amoria Margo, and the magazine's not even coming out for 4 months, and they know that that's going to be cool because I'm going to be there, right? Inside my book, which is right here, Robert Simonson did my foreword, and somewhere in there it says something along the lines of, like, Souther Teague's an unusual bartender in that he, an unusual bar owner in that he himself is behind the bar most nights. That's important. So that's what I was doing. I was making sure that the place had a strong foundation and a strong personality, kind of my personality. The bar is me. And that people knew that it was reliable, right? Bars and restaurants become a reliable thing in people's lives. You know, the third place, right? You know that. Yeah. You know what that is, right? Your audience may not. The third place is work's your first, home's your first place, work is your second place, and then there's that place you like to go.
Yeah.
It's a park, it's a library, it's a bar, it's a restaurant. That third place that is just your
extension. It is so important. And it's something that's going slowly got away from everyday part of life that we need to bring back. And I think that's like the one saving grace about the restaurant industry is, in a world that's increasingly digitized, there's a hunger for that third place where you can go be a human and remember what it means to sit around a table with people and have conversation and look in eyes and break bread. Like, we're so important.
Breaking bread and being around the flowing bowl, right?
Yeah.
We want to get a little social lubricant. We want to exchange gossip and news and, you know, talk about the weather, things we can control and things we can't control. Get a little fed, get a little drunk maybe.
And, it's good. And have you read the book Drunk by Edward Slingerland?
No.
It takes I'm taking you totally up. Do you want to finish? What were we talking about before I make us go down?
Well, so we were talking about, like, what was I doing in that period? I was making the bar the third place for a lot of people, including myself.
Putting butts in seats, asses in seats, which is, I made a note. We came back to it, so I'm happy you did that.
Yeah, which is ironic since we don't have seats there.
So you're saying the way you do that is by being consistent, being present, becoming an expert, developing relationships, being dependable.
Yeah, you can be. I would say, really, this is the first time I've ever thought of this, even though I've had this conversation a lot of times. What we've just talked about, you know, sushi, spaghetti, tacos. Well, I wouldn't want my business to be that. Well, I don't want me to be that either. I want to know that I know. Like, when I was a chef and I worked at, a French restaurant, I know how to make Italian food, but I didn't do it there, right? But it doesn't mean I don't know. I contain multitudes,
right?
So I think that you should have a good grasp on kind of the sort of spread of what it is we do, and a special grasp on the thing that you do specifically. Mm. Become known for, be the guy who makes the best fucking mojito. Right. I don't know what it is, but you can be the guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think it's interesting. And this happens all the time. You're not the first person. It comes up a lot. I like to bring attention to it when it happens, but you, in this interview, you've contradicted yourself. Oh, early
I contradict
on.
Myself all the time.
But I think that it's like one of these things where you have this, like you say yes to everything early on, and get that perspective and move around. But over time, you're going to be internalizing and figuring out. But you can't get that perspective and figure. You would have never found out if you wanted to be that you love the bar if you didn't give yourself different perspective. You
for sure.
You have to let yourself fall in love with something. And when you're dating people, or like date a lot of people, figure out what you're into. You know, figure out what works for you.
It's like shopping for clothes, man.
And eventually, you're going to find the one.
Try a bunch of stuff on.
Yeah.
Some of it comes home.
But everything you say yes
to. Some of it gets sent back.
Everything you say yes to is also something you have to say no to, because we will all only have 24 hours in a day.
Right.
So eventually you get it's on a sliding scale. Say yes early on. And then as you start to find your passion, your love, and then like slow
down.
Yeah,
that first bar job that I had. So, you know, I had come off from being a research chef and a teaching chef. So, you know, somewhat research oriented, somewhat, you know, nerdy.
Hungry. You're nerdy learning.
Sure. Nerd, I don't say in a bad way. I'm a nerd, whatever.
We need more nerds in this world. So. Geeks and nerds have their place.
So when I got behind that first bar, it was almost like, okay, well, I had already been working at, you know, French place and Italian place and cooking and, you know, honing in on that and being a technician and being, you know, kind of like really good at whatever it is I'm doing based on how it's made by going and doing some research, right? But when I got behind the bar, it was like scattershot at first. It was like, I'm making everything I can make. I'm, this is, you know, back in 2003, 2004, and I'm trying to find books and whatever. And there aren't that, the internet's not that easily accessible. There aren't a lot of blogs yet, you know, things like that. I'm looking around to try and find stuff, and I'm making, you know, whatever. I'm making, you know, woo-woos and, you know, pina coladas and, you know, found with the Ramos gin fizz, this crazy drink with eggs in it, you know. I'm making everything, you know. Old fashions are coming into play. Negronis are popping up on the screen. I'm trying to make it all. And then to your point, I started sort of like over the years being like, these are the drinks I kind of like. This is my style. This is what I'm really into. And then I opened a bar that is nothing but Amaro. And
right. Beers. You carved out a future for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I found that that's what I liked making, that's what I liked drinking, that's what I had, you know, interest in. There was plenty of stuff to look up and read and talk about with Amaro, and, you know, bitters were coming back on the scene in a humongous way, which is now incredible. You know, I have like over 500 bitters at the bar.
Right.
It's crazy. Where, you know, easily when I was the head bartender at Rye in Williamsburg here in Brooklyn, it was right before Amore Margo, so it'd be 2009, 2010. You know, I had to scrounge around to find Regan's orange bitters.
So one thing I
had to really go looking to find Regan's orange bitters, which are ubiquitous now. And now there's also Scrappy's orange. And
I mean, you helped bitter bring that though. That must be
in
cool
some ways,
to know.
Right? It's a little bit of, it's a two-way street.
So one thing I absolutely want to make sure we touch on, and are you still trying to get a thought out? Cause I don't want to cut you short.
I cool. Wrapped it up.
I really want to make sure we touch on, it seems like just through following your timeline and, seeing around 2017, you publish your book, I'm Just Here for the Drinks. You launch your podcast in 2018, the Speakeasy podcast. You're really starting to,
Speakeasy's been on for 13 years.
Really?
I joined the team.
Oh, that's right.
In 2017. You mentioned that.
But it seems like there's almost like a transition of you trying to remove yourself from only being a barman, right? Like,
well,
you're kind of more intentional about like creating a business around you.
Yeah. I think I would say, you know, again, not to make our conversation completely cyclical over and over again, but, you know, I'm an alpha. I'm a creative. There are things that I want to get out of my head, you know. Getting this book out of my head was a big thing for me. Like, I just needed to download.
Do you have extra copies of that book here? I'll absolutely purchase one from you today.
Yeah, of course.
I would love to have a copy.
Of course. I'll even, you know.
A little signature, John Hancock?
Sure. But, you know, the book was just a download to get all this stuff out of my brain. And now I'm about ready to do another one. Right. I'm in talks with my editor to do book two, which would be called something like Drinks with Friends, or Drinking with My Friends, or Drinking with Friends. He wants the word drinks in there. Time together, I guess. I don't know. So the book came out. And yeah, what I'm trying to do, I think, is be creative. There's other things here on the table that the listener can't see, but if you're watching, I make a couple of different bitters, which I launched one.
Feel free to hold those up in front of your face, because I'm not sure they're in.
Sure. So I launched Driftwood Bitters, which are cinnamon and grapefruit, right? Like, I have the world's largest collection of bitters at my bar, and I looked around and I was like, how come no one does cinnamon and grapefruit, which is Don's Mix, right? It's a common thing in the tiki world. Cinnamon syrup with grapefruit juice is called Don's Mix. Why can't I make that for stirred drinks? Then the next year I made Garden Party, another one that doesn't exist. It's cucumber, basil, and ginger. Like, it's real bright. So this one's kind of like darker spirits. This one's kind of lighter spirits. I made hot sauces. this past year, I made Desert Curse, which is my habanero pineapple mezcal, right? And I sold this as like former chef, current bartender. This is good for culinary and cocktail use. Then I launched a second one because I did it through Kickstarter, and one of my stretch goals was to make a second flavor. It's actually the same flavor. It's just fresh habanero in this one and dried habanero in this one, so it's much smokier, darker, much more spicy. But they're both quite good in both drinks and food.
But what does it say on those bottles?
What do you mean?
Whose brand is
on
those
it's me,
bottles?
Right? It's my right. skull. It's my glasses.
Right. It's not Amari. These right?
are
Amari, right?
Right. These are Southers bitters. Yeah, it's not Amore Margo.
So I what I want to talk about is this idea of just kind of, and also, I mean, you have your digital brand. You know, you have what, 28,000 followers?
Something like that on Instagram. And then I'm also Amore Margo. I'm also Speakeasy podcast. So I have, you know, I don't know, 40 something thousand, maybe 50.
Not huge. Is the future where we're all doing this?
I think, you know, I don't think it's the future. I think it's now. Yeah. And the answer is yes. Nobody who's in our field No, I can't say like accountants. You know, I can't say like a shoe salesman, but like nobody in our field anyway, front or back of the house, isn't their own brand. You got to sell yourself. If you're out front and you're behind the bar, you're selling yourself no matter what. You're already doing it. So you may as well expand that into an audience that maybe can or can't visit you, but maybe they'll want to one day. You know, I remember long ago, back when I was at Rye, pre-Amore Margo, Rye was a Michelin star chef, owned a restaurant here in Waynesburg. The 22-foot solid mahogany bar built in the 1860s, fucking gorgeous, like a Cadillac. I loved it with all my heart. So beautiful. But I remember pretty clearly Twitter was, you know, still not in its infancy, but it was still, you know, a young thing. And I was doing well on there. I had, you know, 8,000 or something followers. And I got gigs from it. You know, it's like it was a revenue generator, but it was also driving asses to seats at the bar. People would want to come in and see me behind the bar. And my bartenders would come on and I'd say, like, are you on Twitter? This is before Instagram. And they'd say, no. And I'd say, well, why not? Well, I don't think it's... And I'd go to the bar and I would pick up the peeler. And I'd be like, what is this? And they're like, it's a peeler. What do you do with it? Oh, well, we use it to make twists. I'd be like, great. And then I'd pick up the paring knife. And I'd be like, what is this? And like, it's a paring knife. I go, what do we do with it? Oh, we cut fruit with it and sometimes we use it to make twists. And I said, oh, so it's just another tool. Get on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's just another tool. So we're all brands. We have to be brands. We have to market ourselves and market the place that we work. If you're a smart bartender, you aren't just standing there waiting for guests to come in. You're getting on these platforms and saying, here's where I'm at. Come see me.
Yeah.
And that's just the bottom line. And again, if you're a chef, you're probably doing the same thing. Here's where I'm at. Come eat my food.
So what's your strategy? Like, get into like your mindset, going back to say 2017. Strategy. like what is your advice for people? Yeah. Just get in there and start doing it. But like, what is your vision for you and like what you're trying to do?
And
like,
for me, I can tell you. Yeah. And I do have kind of a strategy, I guess. It's just been such a long game. I haven't paid attention to it.
Before you answer that, we're going to take a quick break to thank our sponsors and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This episode is brought to you by Mies. Running the back of house brings a whole suite of challenges, like distributing intellectual property from your chef's brain to your back of house team across all of your locations. Once that information gets distributed, you still have to train your back of house to ensure the recipes are being executed accurately and consistently. Once everybody is trained, you still have to nail down profit calculations, which can be a nightmare when your team doesn't fully understand theoretical food costs, factoring in yields, and unit conversions. Then, once all this is done, you still have to push the information across all of your locations in real time, factoring in the prices that are constantly changing. Are you kidding me? That's where Mies comes in. With Mies, you can standardize your culinary intellectual property and stay in sync as a team. You can train your team quickly and maintain dish consistency by turning your recipes into interactive training material, and you can get laser accurate food costs because Mies allows you to calculate the yields of your ingredients with prep loss included. Create a free account by visiting getmeez.com/unstoppable. That's getmeez.com/unstoppable. And as a listener of Restaurant Unstoppable, you can get 25 recipes uploaded to your Mies account for free. Sign up today and learn more at getmeez.com/unstoppable. We're back. And you were just telling me about your strategy. You're going to get into like, what is it? The long
long game is what you said. Let's pick up
It's a long game, or it has been for me. If I were to redo it, I think it would be a much shorter game. I think I would lean heavily into social media to drive people to come to the places that I work and which I did. I just didn't do it heavily. I thought it had value. I didn't see the value that it has. It has way more value than I gave it.
So it sounds like you don't put energy into the restaurant brand as much as you put into your brand online. Is that safe to say? And sorry if I'm wrong.
I would say it's about 50%.
Okay.
50-50. Maybe I've slipped off the mountain a little bit on Amore Margo because I've been working on some other projects, but I'll get back to it and it'll be 50-50. You know, we didn't have Instagram for Amore Margo for a long time and we had Twitter, but as soon as Twitter switched over to X, I got out of it. I haven't started a Threads for Amore Margo. But we didn't have Amore Margo Instagram for a long time because someone was sitting on the name. It just had one post on it that was years old at the time. And it's a name. It's not like Amore Margo is the name of my bar, but it's also a phrase. It means love and bitter. So someone just chose it. It was a Spanish, probably Spanish person who had the account. And I had to, I had an assistant at the time and I had them just hammer Instagram, just shoot them a message daily to be like, no one's using this and I want it. No one's using it. And they were like, use Amore Margo 1, use Amore Margo NY. And I was like, nope, it's Amore Margo or nothing. And finally, they gave it to me. So it's definitely years behind, and that's why maybe it has a lower count than mine does. But I work on it just as much. But so back to strategy. If I were to go back and do it, I would lean heavily into there and push people to come to the bar because again, it's just as good as a billboard on a highway. It's just as good as an ad in the back of the paper or on the news
it's staying top of mind.
Yeah. It's just getting something out there, whether they can ever come or not. If someone from, fucking Des Moines, Iowa is looking at my Amore Margo Instagram and they're like, man, I wish I could go there and get that Adamaro Sazerac one day. If I ever make it to New York, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
But if they don't come, that's fine. It doesn't hurt me to make them want to come.
I think there's something to be said too with, again, I think New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Austin, Texas, these markets that most everybody has, I feel like a lot of people have gone to those cities, right?
I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches to be in New York, right? We're a hub. If you're coming and going from the country, from the east side here, you're probably coming and going through us.
Right. So I feel like there is, I don't disagree with what you're saying. I think it's, especially unique to what you're saying, it makes absolute sense that social media, because you have a worldwide market, because there's a good chance somebody on the other side of the country is going to be in New York one day and their perspective. You get a lot of people that are just coming in for the day, right? But you also have your regulars.
Yeah. And we have a lot of what I call satellite regulars because of my
in New York
relentless promotion. A satellite is a little bit of a wider orbit. They don't come once a week. They come every time they're in town, whatever that is, once a month, once every 6 months,
right?
And that's how you keep them engaged,
right?
So again, if I could go back, I would lean more heavily on it. So that's what I would recommend to people. And then you ask, like, kind of what am I doing? I'm trying to shift my own persona from regular Joe, right as the mail, always there bartender, to I hate to say it out loud, elder statesman. I'm 54.
Not getting younger.
I got to own it, right?
Although with AI, they're saying that we might be able to live forever. Who knows?
Yay.
I don't know how I feel.
Do you want this forever?
I don't think so.
So, I'm trying to become this sort of like authority. I sit on the tasting panel for LA Spirits Awards and New Orleans Spirits Competition. I have my podcast. I have my book. I'm going to write another book. I'm just in the midst of signing a deal with VinePair. I'm going to put out a twice monthly column with them that's all about the philosophy of bartending. I try and put up content on my social platforms that are inviting and sharing. I want the barrier of entry to be low. I do have a class that I teach once a month that's online called Southern Hospitality with Gush. It's a company called Gush. It's a subscription thing and we're in our fourth season. I'm trying to just establish myself as like a person who is noteworthy, expert in the field and trustworthy.
Yeah.
And Professor Teague.
Yeah. I mean, but I think this is the way to be thinking. And I think that as we move into the experience economy, as we spend our, for you, 40 years in restaurants?
I mean, yeah, again, my dad owned a bar when I was 12.
Yeah. So like, something
I worked at.
We have knowledge. We have, you carve out niches for yourself and there's opportunity as you become more of an expert to create experience around your expertise. And we are in the experience economy. Sure. And there's get outside the four walls of your restaurant and think.
You have to.
Yeah, and think about how can I use the digital assets at my disposal today to bring my customer into my restaurant without ever leaving their house. Literally just like, or using events. There's so many tools to reach people and to promote ourselves today. And if you develop this personal brand, if your restaurant has enough of a brand where you can create events around it, like there's just so much opportunity with selling events and live like demos or what. Continue with the strand of thought.
Sure.
To be your words.
Classes, events that we do here that are live and in person. I will go to other people's homes. I've done that. And I have several of those on my docket right now. And I don't mean just here. I'm flying down to D.C. to do one on April 6th at someone's home. And then I have one for Portland somewhere later in the year. And then I do things in my own home, right? I do an event here at my home, also called Southern Hospitality, where I invite people here in groups of 12. And we do they get hands-on instruction on making two separate drinks, one stirred, one shaken. They get a culinary demo. They get a tasting of a spirit. So, for instance, we did the Greenpoint cocktail, which involves chartreuse. So we did a tasting of yellow, green, VEP, and elixir while we sipped on that cocktail. They get the shaken drink is always a royale, meaning it's topped with champagne. So we do the demo of savoring the champagne. We get some of the participants to do that as well. So it's like teaching and enjoying at the same time. I get to enjoy the party, but I'm teaching them at the same time. And it's tons of fun. So I'm just trying to establish myself now as kind of a resource, an authority, you know, that sort of person.
I mean, can you get more into like the actual, and this is all great stuff, and I think it's a great example, but like, where do you start? Like, for example, like I look at your Southern Hospitality website and ready to dive into a craft of cocktail making. 1, select your kit. 2, subscribe to the show. 3, craft great cocktails. So like,
yeah, let's go.
Like, so like in terms, you have seasons, like what is like the actual strategy and like, what are you doing and like, what platform are you building this on? Like,
so into,
like,
this is Gush is the platform. Gush is a, they're a platform. They do, they got really big during the pandemic cause they do mostly Zoom stuff and kind of corporate stuff, but they had some shows on their platform for a while that were like Jack Schramm, my good friend Jack Schramm, and Dave, Arnold had a show on there called Out of Balance or In Balance or something like that, where they would, you know, nerd out on, you know, molecular cocktails. Then Jack had another show where he would, I don't remember what that show was called, but I was a guest on the show once where he would make, it was always a classic cocktail he would make, and then the guest would make their kind of twist on it, and the audience would vote. And we send kits out to your house. You're doing this with us. It's live, so you can chat with us at the same time. It's also archived, so it's a 6-month. Mine is a 6-month class, so if you can't make every one of them, you can still go back.
So
and
every
watch
6 months
it.
Is a season,
basically, yeah.
And are you doing like a different, like, is there a new?
Yeah, I was getting there. So how my show started was, you know, we're into the fourth season now, so it's 2 years ago. My show started, it was called The Bitter's Truth. I did not name it. The team at Gush did. The Bitter's Truth. And the whole class was 6 episodes, and we made several different bitters and made cocktails using them. So, for instance, the first class was you got this box that comes to your house before it all starts. It's everything in here you need for the 6-month class. And the first class had a little tiny bottle of Angostura and a little tiny bottle of Regan's Orange. And we made a drink using Angostura, and then we made, and all the stuff in there to make, an aromatic-style bitters. But that's not ready yet, right? It's going to take a while. But each class is only a month apart. So you got your kind of your Ango analog that you made with me. And then we made a drink using orange bitters. And then we made a citrus bitters together. And then in a month, those bitters are ready. We strain them. We make cocktails using those. But we make 2 new ones for the next class.
Okay, so I'm going to pause you real quick. Yeah. So this is a combination of online course,
yeah,
meal kit, live events, digital live events.
Yeah, for sure.
So like, this is how we need to start thinking.
Yeah.
And like, and I mean, I saw prices. I was poking around last night. Okay, so just $20 a month.
That's just to subscribe to get on the Gush platform.
So you're paying $20 a month, and when you're on the Gush platform, you have all these different creators out there. Mm. And then you can subscribe to your channel.
Right.
And then what are you charging for, like, Is it $200?
The kit, I think, is $200. There's a bonus, not a bonus, but there's an extra kit that has all the glassware you need that thinks $100. So it basically comes out to about $400 to take the whole 6-month course.
Got it. So you're I'm assuming you're also making affiliate marketing because you're probably like, here's a PDF with all the tools you need. Linking to Amazon.
We haven't done that yet, but that's our next step.
Okay.
You know, we're pretty young at this. We're hopefully going to do that, and then if we can get to season 5, which I think we can, season 4 you still have a chance. I don't know when this show is going to come out, but season 4 you still have a chance to get in on. Episode 1 is next Thursday, but we always repeat episode 1 and give a little gap of time for stragglers who want to get the kit ordered, so you can still get on board. The next season we would then probably do affiliates with brands.
Yeah. Education is a big part of the experience economy.
For sure.
When you can tie your personal brand to newfound knowledge, anytime somebody goes to show somebody, oh, look at this new drink I made, mm-hmm. they're going to say, oh, Sother Teague. It all comes back. And that's how you get your name out there. But it looks like you have 3 tiers. I think this is also really smart. Don't just like a restaurant.
Gush set up the, I don't know, but yes, well, I understand what you're saying. There are tiers, yeah.
But like at a restaurant, you have your PBR.
Yeah.
And you have your limited release small batch drink, sure. right? That's like $15 a pour. Have the $4 option. Have the one that's 10 times that option sure. for the person who wants to spend that money. So you have your $49 to $85 for the glassware for just a kit. Then you have your glassware kit, which is $99. And then you have your pantry box, which is $199. Yeah, so give people the options.
Everything you need, yeah.
Yeah. I just think this is really smart. I haven't heard of Gush yet. I'm surprised this is the first time I've heard of them.
Pretty small, but mighty.
So do you know what a ClickFunnel is? Are you using ClickFunnels?
Not yet. I do know what they are. As far as I know, Gush doesn't use them, but
okay. Oh, it's just, I think it's really just an idea of like, you know, you have my understanding of a ClickFunnel is that you have wild, wild west, and that's where people like social media, your podcast, your email list, basically wherever you're putting yourself out free, YouTube channel, whatever, sure. where people can discover you, you want to get them to your nurture, which it could be an email list. Sorry, I put email list out into the wild, wild west. So your nurture is typically an email list or a private Facebook group or something that's more value, but not like it's like behind a door, right. maybe not a pay gate, but you're trading contact information right. to get it. Trying to get an email for your restaurant so you can add them to your list.
Yeah.
Same idea. And then there's the pay gate of like, you love my content so much. You can join me live. I'm transparently, this is exactly what I'm doing with Restaurant Unstoppable Network.
Great.
We
should talk off air.
Yeah. I'd love to have you come. Like, I have value. I know all these people. I can help. And it's all word of mouth people that have been right. referred to me organically. There's something there. There's a value to that.
Yeah.
Recognize your value. Help bring people together for live events. And you're doing it here, and I think this is really brilliant.
Yeah, it's fun. And again, moving into the 4th season, we really amped up all the value. Like, we really went hard on the kit that you get delivered this time around. We created a label. Like, usually we send you like bottles for the resulting bitters or whatever you're making. And we created bottles with labels, and on the labels are QR codes that go back to the episode so you can quickly reference things you want to look at. And we made a really beautiful handbook for this season. Like, we really upped the game this year. Or this season to try and really get people on board.
Yeah. I think the best thing about this approach, were you about to say something? I cut you short?
Nope.
The best thing about this approach is that there is no ceiling.
Yeah.
You can charge whatever you want as long as there's demand. If the demand is there.
Right. And I think the really great thing about this is, and we haven't, you know, gotten to the place where we'd have to realize this yet, but the really great thing about this is, you know, we have typically around 50 people in the class each time, but it could easily be, you know, 100. It could be 500. I'm going to do it if there's one person there. I'm doing the same thing if there's one person or if there's 50 or 100. So this is kind of scalable, right? Again, I can't be in all these people's homes. Many of them are in, you know, Arizona or, you know, California or somewhere here in New York. But they can all zoom into me at once.
Right, right, right. Now, do you have to be asked by Gush to do this, or can you reach out to Gush and get your own channel? How does that work?
I bet Richard's the guy who runs Gush. I bet he would be looking for other shows.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I'm the last show standing because Jack went off, you know, the pandemic kind of ended and all these people went back to their jobs.
Yeah.
But they liked doing shows. Yeah. They have a studio. Like, it's beautiful.
We haven't talked about your podcast much yet.
No, it's great. You should listen.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a
welcome
target
back
audience.
To the Speakeasy.
Yeah. So, what is the vision, or what was the idea? What's the mission of Speakeasy?
Yeah. Speakeasy is a it's a fly on the wall opportunity for the listener to sort of be in the room while industry, you know, notables are having an after work conversation. We're not. I'm sure you're not either. We're not like gotcha journalism or anything.
What's gotcha journalism?
You know, where you're like trying to like catch somebody, you know, for doing something stupid. Like we don't have anybody
whistleblowing.
We don't. Yeah, we don't have anybody on if we don't like them.
Okay.
You know, we're not trying to get anybody and catch them in a moment. You know.
Oh.
And I wouldn't even, you know, stretch to call it journalism. It's just interviewing, like we're doing today. All good and friendly and upfront. Right. But we talk to everybody. I mean, 13 years in, you're 10 years in. We've talked to door people, cocktail servers, bartenders, bar owners, authors, distillers, makers, ambassadors, writers. You know, like it's the gamut is there. People from coffee, people from tea. Like if it's drinkable, we've had them on the Speakeasy. And you know, this past year we won the Spirited Award at Tales of the Cocktail for best podcast, broadcaster, online video series.
Congratulations!
You should try and get your name in that hat. Yeah, we were nominated every year since the category existed. We were nominated.
I had Neil Bodenheimer on the show.
Yeah, he's great.
Neil, help me out, man. Yeah.
Year the category existed, we were nominated, and every year the category existed, we made it to top four until for 7 years. So until this year, we finally won.
Yeah. Well, congrats.
Well, but now we can't even be nominated for 5 years. So I think it's like maybe we shouldn't have won.
Well, I mean,
we should have Susan Lucci'd this thing, you know?
Yeah. So like, are you just trying to have conversations? Is that the idea of just, is there an education?
It's totally just conversations. Of course there's education that just, you know,
organically happens.
That's not the goal. We do try and like, kind of run themes from time to time, you know, especially things that exist. Like we try to put some light on some folks in our field that are black for Black History Month. We try to put some light on folks that are LGBTQIA during Pride Month. We try and focus on women during Women's History, or you know, Women's was it Women's History? No, Women's. There's a Women's
National
month.
Women Month.
Yeah, I think
it was last month, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or was it this month?
Yeah, it's this month. Yes, because we've had a couple of ladies on. You know, we try and just pay attention to that, or at least bring it up when we talk. But it's just me, Damon Bolte, another industry dude here in New York, and a guy named Greg Benson. Greg worked a little bit behind bars, but he's also just in the world of podcasts, actually, and he's got his own. A couple of podcasts that are on the side that he does that are more scripted. You know, he does a pretty good job with that kind of stuff. But so he's just a curious person in the spirits world. So, yeah, the three of us just sit and talk to luminaries or just regular Joes from our field and get their insight. You know, we talk to dive bartenders to, you know, we've had the team from the aviary on. You
right.
know, like we run the full gamut. And having done it for so long, similar to you, I assume, there's almost a no-nos. Like if we reach out to someone and say, would you like to be on the show? They say yes.
Yeah.
Which is an amazing feeling.
Have you gotten to the point where you get a lot of requests to be on the show?
For sure.
I kind of liked it better when I had to ask people to be on the show, if I'm being honest.
Like it's weird to have to say no to people, right?
It's the worst thing. If I said yes to everybody, I wouldn't have my own show. It would be just like, you know, I'd just be giving everybody an episode.
Right.
I mean, I should be way more fortunate, feel like way more grateful for that. It's a good problem to have.
Yeah,
it's a way good easier to beg and plead and say no.
Yeah, it is a good problem, but it's still a problem, right?
Yeah.
Problems need solutions, which is I think what your whole approach is. But yeah, the Speakeasy, I love it. You know, we do it largely for free. We don't get paid for it. It's a nonprofit Heritage Radio Network that we're on. We have been trying to look into it and find out. We may in fact be the longest running food and drink podcast. Drink podcast in existence.
Really? Yeah.
Right. Because we've been on podcasting only started in 2009. We've been on since 2011.
Food and drink. I know in terms of like restaurant business, I'm up there pretty close, but I wouldn't consider myself a food and drink. I honestly try to avoid talking about food and drink.
Yeah.
Because it's not my thing. It's the business, the people, the social studies, the everything associated with the industry that's not discussed is what I like to think I talk about.
So your show's been on for 10 years.
10 years.
And you started the show because you thought you wanted to get some information so you could maybe open a restaurant. Well, 10 years ago?
10 years ago. So I grew up in the restaurant industry.
You could have a 10-year-old restaurant right now.
I know. Well, there's more to the story. I know many of my listeners know the story, but I grew up in the restaurant industry. Had parents that talked me out of working in restaurants. They, you know, because they knew better. Like, why are you doing this? Have you learned nothing being her son? The restaurant industry right. sucks. Still had the desire to work in restaurants. I thought I'd become a commercial pilot. And they'd use the money as a commercial pilot to then open a restaurant later in life. Did the whole commercial pilot thing. All I got out of that was $200,000 in school loan debt, resigned at the age of 26, found myself wanting to go back into the restaurant industry, but I couldn't pay off my debt with a restaurant job. So I was like, well, if I can't work in restaurants, I want to work with restaurants. Thought I'd get into sales as a wine rep, discovered podcasting during this time and was looking for a restaurant business podcast. Couldn't find it, started one because I was looking for it. And I right. thought that maybe I could scale this podcast and then use the money from the podcast to invest in my own business.
But amazing.
Turns out running a full-time 2-episode-a-week podcast is pretty demanding. Yeah. So I don't really have the extra bandwidth to open the restaurant, but I still have the dream. I would love to be an investor or right. like something like that.
I mean, my show is only once a week and there's 3 of us and it's still a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. But it's fun. It's real fun.
It's again, we don't really get paid for it. We get like some loose change here and there, you know, we get some sponsorship and but there's 3 of us. And so like,
but it's also a great wild, wild west lead generator for everything else that you do.
Oh, of course.
Listen, right.
Listen, lead generator. That's a great term. Yeah. My bitters, my hot sauce, my books, like all my Gus show, all of this.
That's stuff. Your wild, wild west.
All this stuff is lead generators. Yeah. yeah. Man. All this stuff gets me gigs. And we didn't even get to talk about this yet, but all this stuff gets me invited all over the world to do talks or sure. to do pop-ups of a more Imargo or to come do guest shifts at bars. It gets me invited to I got invited to be a spirits, LA Spirits Award judge, you know, I got invited to be, and I'm still on those things. Right. So, and those things pay, right. So like, it's like, even when I was saying earlier on, like way, way back when I first had Twitter, like I had, you know, 7,000 followers or whatever the fuck it was. And I would get job offers and I would take them,
yeah.
you know, come do this gig, come be a, you know, come do a gig in our home for a party. Yeah, fine. Let's do
yep.
it.
Yeah. Can you believe it's almost been 2 hours?
It's made me a better negotiator.
No, I do. Yeah, I do wow. want to respect the two-hour block that we had.
Yeah, of course.
I do want to start kind of. So the format of my show, if anybody hasn't figured out, crack the code. It's where'd you come from? Where are you today? Where are we going?
Ooh, right. Let's go together.
So like, where are you and where are we going? Where's the industry going? And like, what are you doing to be ready for the future? And like, how do we go into the future intentional? And I think this is really how we're going to transform the industry, is sharing knowledge and saying yeah. there are better paths that we can all take together.
Yeah.
So what do you think the future is? Like where do you think we're going?
I think one of the things that the future holds for us is a little bit more collaboration. Mm-hmm. And I don't just mean like you come to a pop-up at my shop or vice versa, or you come and, you know, get behind my bar or vice versa. I mean, you know, we talked about it a little bit off air, so I'm going to kind of try and regurgitate this a little bit. But, you know, National Restaurant Association says that only 1 in 5 bars or restaurants makes it to their 5th birthday. Right? So that's 20% success rate, 80% fail rate. Not good.
Right.
That's not good. And we all know it going into it. Like, none of us are like blind to that number. You know, we still do it. People still get married, even though 55% of marriages end in a divorce. You got less than a half a chance, you know? But you still do it. You're confident. It's not going to happen to us. We're going to make
right.
it.
We're different.
We're going to make it. But then we see suddenly a place will throw up a sign or hit their Instagram and say, guys, sorry, we're closing in 2 weeks. What I would like to see in our future, what I'm hoping for with the advent of more connectivity through social media, et cetera, is that people who are running that business that's about to throw up that signal saying we're closing at the end of the month can throw up a signal 6 months before that
right.
and say, we're struggling, and have us all come to the rescue is the wrong word, but have us all rally.
Yeah. Before you fall over the edge of the
how
the
can I help
waterfall?
You? How could I? So there's a specific place in my mind that just closed at the top of the month. That's in my neighborhood, just one block away from my bar, a place that I liked going, a place that I enjoyed, a place that I enjoyed their staff, their team, their ownership. And they just threw up a signal and just said, we're closing at the yeah. end of the month. If they had said, hey, things aren't going well, I would have been like, why don't I come do a pop-up at your place?
Right.
I'll draw some attention to you. Why don't we do a collaborative post on Instagram? Why don't we, you know, come up with a dish that's a secret, or come up with a drink from my bar that you'll serve at your bar that's a secret and you don't right. know unless you know. And so people can go get the thing that's a secret and they'll come here first and then I'll send them there. You know, like, what can we do to collaborate? Because the high tide raises all boats. I've said that all my life. About many other things, but in this business, it's the fucking truth. You know,
right.
people come to Sorry, I'm getting a little excited.
No,
here.
Please.
People come to Amore Margo, my bar, East Village, 6th Street, Avenue A. They come there, and I do not for one second, not never have, never will, expect that that's where they're going to spend their entire evening. They came to the East Village. They came to sort of the ground zero mecca of cocktails in New York City, which is kind of the mecca of cocktails in the world. They're going to go to Amore Margo. They're going to go next door to Death & Co. They're going around the corner to PDT. Then they're going to swing down to the Lower East and hit up Bar Goto. But on their way, they're going to stop at Super Bueno. They're excited that Schmucks is opening up on my block. They're going to hit that when it's open. You know what I mean? They're making a night of it. There's a circuit here.
Yeah.
So not only is the high tide raise all boats, we are nothing without those other boats.
Right, 100%. I think Dan Haggerty from Industry East in Manchester, recent guest I had on the show, awesome bar program there, said it best when he said, it's not competition, it's commerce.
Yeah,
and
1,000%.
And that's, and we go further together. And the more you are willing to lean on others and let others lean on you, you will go further. And I think when I started this podcast, I was terrified that I was going to go to these restaurant owners. And I think there's just the stigma associated with the industry where you're like, you keep your secrets close to your chest. You don't let recipes out. Like, you hang on to your people, like all this stuff. I was like, who's going to open up? I was so inspired by these entrepreneurs in the tech world and like the leading edge of industries, like sharing information about how they made their millions online. Mm-hmm. And I was like, who is going to give me this level of transparency in the restaurant industry? But I think you've been seeing it over the past 10, 15 years where people are more so opening up. And
listen, realizing there's no other field of endeavor that I can think of where I could say, read in a I'm not reading, Accountant Monthly magazine. And I see that some accountant in Portland, Oregon has come up with some new way of crunching numbers, and that I could just DM his ass on his Instagram and be like, hey man, tell me all about that. Mm-hmm. And that he'd do it. Right. He'd be like, fuck you, figure it out. In my business, I read Imbibe magazine. I see Jeff Morgenthaler in Portland, Oregon is doing something cool with barrel aging and Negroni. I fucking DM him and I'm like, what's up, man? He's like, dude, this is how I do it. It's fucking cool.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised at how many people are willing to help and willing to open up and willing to share information.
Well, I learned a hard lesson years ago. I was a contributing author to a cookbook, and we learned together. We didn't know. We were young, dumb dudes. That you can't copyright recipes. So your best opportunity is to give it away and establish provenance.
Right.
So we are, still to this day, I'm quite free with every recipe at Amore Margo. If you come to Amore Margo and ask for a recipe, we've even got these little cards that we made that we'll write it on the back of it and give it to you. It's got a beautiful picture of me on the front.
Be the first record of it.
provenance, right?
Yeah.
So that maybe, you're never going to get a dollar from this, but maybe if another bar or restaurant around the fucking world puts your dish on the menu, they'll give you some credit.
Right.
The Sharpie mustache from Amore Margo in East Village of New York City.
Or if it becomes as popular as the Buffalo Wing that you know that you can't find any mention of it prior to this point.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the way I think that people are starting to feel about, because the thing is, like, it's a dumb analogy, but I've used it before. Like, I go to the museum to see the Magritte exhibit. I get shuttled through the gift shop on the way out. I buy the Magritte book. I come home. I don't try and make a Magritte. This is for inspiration. This is for beauty. This is for posterity. the ass end of it all. This is for, like I said, sort of inspiration. Yeah. Like, I was a chef for a long time. I've got Keller's French Laundry cookbook downstairs, and there's a chapter in there that I still cry when I read it. The one where he had to kill the rabbit. Very disturbing.
I heard about that. I never read the book.
It's very touching.
Yeah.
I've looked at that book for inspiration numerous times. I've never made a fucking thing out of there. It's there for inspiration, right? So you're not giving away your recipe. And even if you are and someone tries to use it, that's homage. That's delightful.
Right.
Right. But generally speaking, the consumer isn't gonna. But if a bar does, if they can at least give you a little like nod, then that just again shows that we're here for commerce, not competition.
Yeah. Awesome stuff. Awesome. I love that, man. Great to hear. What is one thing about you, your business, a value, a process, a system, something that's truly uncommon that makes you unstoppable?
Unstoppable. I don't know that I am unstoppable. We didn't talk about this at all, but like, I've had a lot of demons in my life. And one of them that stuck with me since I was literally in high school when I was, middle school, sorry, when I was diagnosed as clinically depressed. So I don't think I'm unstoppable. I think I have a lot of things that I have to deal with, just like everyone does. I think that, I just try and take things as they come. I try and get excited when I can get excited. And I try and move forward even if I'm not excited.
humility.
Yeah.
No,
could,
I mean,
it could be. Yeah. I think there's that. And I guess once you're, once you're of consciousness age, you understand that you have no choice in the matter. So you may as well keep moving forward. Yeah. We're going to move forward whether we choose to or not.
Right.
Can we move forward in the path that we want to, or are we just going to get pushed along like a leaf in the wind?
So our mission statement is to change the world by inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. How have you personally transformed? Who is Souther today versus Souther way back when you first got started in this industry?
I mean, I think it's, you just said humility, which makes me think of my ego, right? I think my ego was a lot larger when I was younger. I think now I'm so much more about my team. And that's been going on for at least a decade. So this is not new stuff. But I'm so much more about my team. You know, I got reached out to recently by Bon Appetit or Food and Wine. I can't remember. And they were doing some article. It hasn't come out yet. I'm excited to see it. But they were doing some article about family trees. You know, like you have a family tree from different restaurant groups, or, you know, who came from Gordon Ramsay, you know, what places have they opened, stuff like that. And they reached out to me and they were like, we'd like to know if you have anybody significant in your family tree, you know, since it more opened. And I was like, holy cow. Like when I stop and think about it, it's like, yeah, it's incredible. You know, Sean Johnson, who I just spoke about, he's now the, you know, East Coast brand ambassador for Hennessy. Kyle Hunter Bailey went off to head the bar at a place called Mansky in L.A. that 2 years ago took the very first ever Michelin award for bar, wow. Michelin star for bar. The very next year, Austin Henley, who used to work for me at Cato, also in L.A., took the Michelin award, the second ever Michelin award for bar. Aaron Polsky went off and opened up his own company of RTDs called Livewire that's won tons of awards. Chris Lauder went off to Asia and worked for Proofing Company, and now he's got his own company consulting literally all over the world. All these people came from a 240 square foot closet in the East Village.
That to me is like success.
And if I can
spurring success,
have any influence over these guys and their success, you know, Blake Walker, who I was just talking about before the show, he's opening his own bar in New York right now. Chris Elford opened several bars in Seattle. And now he's opened Here Today Seattle, which is a huge brewery. These are all folks who worked at Amore Margo.
All names being added to my list of potential future
yeah,
guests.
Yeah, let's get them on.
I will be taking note of this during the editing process for sure. I'd love to get them on. And this is the last question before we start to really finish it up and we give you a chance to call some people out. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your restaurants would be lost with your departure.
Totally leaving.
But you could leave three pieces of wisdom behind for your legacy and for the good of humanity. What would those three pieces of wisdom be? It's heavy.
Man, first of all, I'd say patience, you know.
One.
Patience is going to change your life. Your patience will reward you. Mm. It's a hard pill to swallow because nothing, I don't think anybody likes to do less than wait. Mm. But if you can wait, things are going to get great.
What's two?
Oof. Three. You need three.
Yeah.
I'll come up with two. I would say I'm not the type of person who talks a lot about stuff. I do it. So to turn a phrase, just do it.
Yeah. Be patient. Just do it.
Yeah.
Number three.
I mean, I already said it earlier. It's a little phrase that I've used a lot throughout my life and career. Plan your work your plan, and be flexible.
Love
so, so patience, do it, but be flexible.
I love it. This has been a lot of fun, Souther. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
So I really want this next question to kind of be my North Star. I'm really trying to, who am I to decide who to make an example of? I mean, the whole reason why I got this camper is I'm trying to get out
I'm
west.
I'm going to come out and see your rig.
Yeah,
I'd love you. Just pulled up in front of my apartment somewhere. I'm going to come out and see this thing.
Please do. I'd love that. And so I can go into a community and just talk to people and just keep my ear to the ground and try to do journalistic work. I'm going to be going all over the country. So if we're along this vein of inspiring and transforming the industry, like who's doing it right? Who is somebody who needs to be made an example of, somebody who has knowledge, who's doing right by others? Like who comes to mind? Who would you want to hear from?
Does that have to be bar and restaurant specific or business that are adjacent?
Food and beverage doesn't have to be the restaurant industry. It can be business adjacent for sure.
Yeah, I would say that one of the most unique business plans I've seen out there that's working is one I just mentioned, Aaron Polsky. He created Livewire, which is an RTD company. And I'm going to butcher it, so sorry, Aaron. But you, if you can get on the show, you can sort it out. He has a degree in both music and business. And I could be butchering that too, Aaron. Sorry. And he put them together. And so his company is he reaches out to bartenders, has them create a drink, right? So he uses the music industry as his template. So he's the record label. The bartender is the band. The drink is the album, right? So the bartender creates a drink. They get to put their own artwork. So that's the album cover on the can or bottle, depending. He does both. And then for as long as Livewire sells this product, that bartender slash band, as long as the company's selling the record, they get a cut.
Oh, that's smart.
It is incredibly smart.
Yeah. And that's
Aaron. And he's won a lot of awards.
Last name?
Polsky, P-O-L-S-K-Y.
Livewire.
Livewire.
Coming after you, Aaron. I'd love to get you on the show. And I don't need to cut you short if you have other people that come to mind, but we can wrap it.
That's... you know, if you haven't gotten a hold of titans like Julie Reiner, she is a business juggernaut. I happened to have the good fortune of sitting next to her at the table at the Tales of Spirited Awards this past year. She was literally my table mate. She was sitting right next to me. And they called her up for the, I don't know what the full name of it is, but their, you know, Lifetime Achievement Award, you know, the Sun Shih Tzu, whatever, Lifetime Achievement Award. And I just looked over at her and I said, I don't know why they're calling you. You're not done. you know, and then she opened up her new bar after that called M'Lady's, and she's the one of the main judges on the new show Drink Masters, and like that happened since you know, wow. The Lifetime
Where's she based?
Award. Here in New York City.
Oh, beautiful.
So she has Clover Club, which is her oldest bar. She's part of Leenda, which is another great bar. She has M'Lady's, which is her newest project. Yeah, she's written books. She's a star.
Julie, Aaron, look out. I'm coming after you. Did you have more? It looks like I cut you short.
No, you're not.
I'll take as many leads as I possibly can. But this has been a lot of fun, man.
I'll leave you with those two, a young one and an older one, right? And no offense, Julie. I don't mean older. I mean, you've been in the game, you know, a newbie and someone with experience.
And before we say goodbye, how can we follow up with you if we've been inspired by today's episode?
Yeah, I run my own social media, which is Creative Drunk. I'm Creative Drunk on Instagram. I'm also on Threads at Creative Drunk, and I am on TikTok, but again, I've only posted like 5 things in a year. I don't really use it. I do have a YouTube channel, Creative Drunk, as well. I don't use that enough either, but if you want to get in touch with me, Creative Drunk, my Instagram, DM me. I run it myself. I answer everything myself.
Look for the glasses.
Look for the red glasses.
I love it. This has been a lot of fun. This is episode 1069. So
ooh, nice.
We just recently switched. I was going to say it, but we moved from WordPress to ClickFunnels platform, and we're still trying to figure out the pretty links associated with all the past episodes. So bear with us. I hope we can maintain our pretty link method. So if you head to restaurantunstoppable.com/1069, we'll have a link to today's episode, a summary of all today's discussions, how to connect, any tools or services that are recommended, all there in the show notes. Or if you're listening to this on Spotify or iTunes, just right in the player. It's right there for you guys. You can get all those links right there. We have show notes on your audio player. And this is where I say thank you so much, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. I do want to drop one more thing. I always forget to drop this one. And I brought this stuff up here so I would remember.
Yeah.
I do have a big cartel store where you can order my book, my bitters, my hot sauces, my tiki mug directly from me. So like I'll sign your book to your name.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And what's the name of that website?
Oh, it's Creative Drunk at Big Cartel. Big Cartel.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And we'll link to that as well.
Thanks.
Now is when I say, there is no questioning. You are unstoppable. Cheers.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you.
There's another episode wrapped up here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guest today, Souther T, for coming on and being a shining example of the new normal. And I love the restaurant industry, the full service, the fine dining, the casual dining, the QSR, the fast casual. These models are great, but there's a whole new tier, a whole new evolution of ways we can leverage digital assets and digital communities to increase our revenue or add new channels of revenue and increase our profitability. And we saw that today with Souther Teague. We saw that last week with Irene Lee. There's just, I want you guys to start thinking like this and to get outside of the normal way of doing business, because there's so much opportunity being left on the table. And I think the past couple of guests have really shown that. So lots of amazing things happening here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Our new website is live. Our Facebook group, our private Facebook group, Unstoppable Restaurant Owners and Operators, is live. If you want to get some behind the scenes footage and recordings of what's happening at Restaurant Unstoppable Network, where we're hosting all of our live events. And we're basically becoming a live events company for the restaurant industry. And we're here to serve you. We're here to listen to you and to you know, join that community. Tell us where the pain is, and we'll go after the people in our community, in our network, to better serve you. We go further together. We have some really cool things happening over at Restaurant Unstoppable Network on April 8th at 12 p.m. Mountain. These are in Mountain Time because that's where Callum Miola is based. But that's going to be 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. We have David Lombardo, the president and CEO of Lombardo Hospitality, part of the legendary Lombardo family, is going to be doing a Q&A. So if you enjoyed his episode, be sure to join Restaurant Unstoppable Network, and you can get a 30-day trial. So be sure to head to the show notes. We'll have a link in the show notes for you to join the network. And as you're listening to this, I am in Atlanta. I'm hanging out there for close to a week, and then I'm going to be bopping around Alabama, Mississippi, New Orleans, the Florida Panhandle, and then I'm heading west, making my way to the West Coast. So if you are in Texas or New Mexico or Arizona or Southern California, reach out to me. I'd love to meet you, and maybe I can park in your driveway with my rig. And I can't say goodbye without saying thank you to Jared Parisi for your copyright and editing under the Samadre podcast brand. And Callan Miola, our community manager, she is crushing it. We're here to serve. We are scaling like crazy, and we could not be more excited. Thank you for your support. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.